Senator, please come back to order. Thank you. Senate File 11, second reading of the bill.
Senate File 11, Youth Challenge Program.
There are no amendments. Any further discussion? Senate File 11, having been read two separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, it's so ordered. Senate File 17, second reading of the bill.
Senate File 17, Notice of Mineral Property Transfer.
Senate File 17, there are no amendments. Any further discussion? There being none, Senate File 17, having been read two separate times, the question is, shall it be read a third time? Hearing no objection, it's so ordered. Senate File 19, second reading of the bill.
Senate File 19, Public Funds Investing.
There are no amendments. Any further discussion? Senate File 19, having been read two separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. Senate File 26, second reading of the bill.
Senate File 26, Lapsing of Appropriated Funds Amendments.
There are no amendments. There's any discussion? There being none. Senate File 26, having been read two separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. Senate File 34, second reading of the bill.
Senate File 34, Uniform Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets Act.
I don't see any objections. I see a person standing. Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I'd ask to have Senate File 34, Uniform Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets Act, laid back for consideration on second reading on Monday of next week for one day.
Are there any objections? There being none, Senate File 34, Uniform Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets Act, is laid back for second reading on Monday.
She's going to do this next one.
Senate File 37, second reading of the bill.
Senate File 37, Boards and Commissions Party Affiliation.
There are no objections or there are no amendments. Senator Kraft.
Thank you so much, Mr. President. I would ask that Senate File 37, Boards and Commissions Party Affiliation, be laid back one day and be considered on Monday.
Are there any objections? There being none, Senate File 37, Boards and Commissions Party Affiliation, is hereby laid back to second reading till Monday. Senate File 38, second reading of the bill.
Senate File 38, Data Management Policies.
We have an amendment. Would the reading clerk please read in the amendment?
Senate File 38, second reading, amendment number 1. Page 1, line 3.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. President, I'd like to move second reading amendment to Senate File 38.
Mike.
Mr. President, I would move Senate File second reading amendment to Senate File 38. Members of the body, I was a no vote on this bill in committee, and let me explain to you why. So, I want to point out the good senior senator from Campbell County picked up this on the first reading, so I want you to look at the effective date on this. This is effective July 1st. It requires a report by September 30th, or September. There's 60 days to provide this report in this bill. So if we go to Section 2, what's that really mean? Says the state chief information officer, in consultation with counties, 23 counties, cities, towns, 99 incorporated cities and towns, and other political subdivisions. I hope you realize that there's over 400 political subdivisions in the state of Wyoming. So in 60 days, the chief operating officer has to consult with over 550 different entities within the state of Wyoming. And I would contend that that's highly unlikely going to happen and unfeasible. So it throws into question is the quality of that consultation and what policies might be derived associated with that. It's an impossible task to get anything meaningfully done in that time period if we really intend to have a consultation with those 550 entities. I would point out that in that 60 days, he probably ought to spend his time working on data policy management for the state agencies that have large data databases. Not to say that this isn't an exercise that shouldn't go forward, but at this point in time, maybe we ought to try it and see how it works at the state level before we jump out there and direct state agency chief information officer to do something that's absolutely infeasible to get done in 60 days. I'd ask for your favorable consideration.
Discussion. Senator Rothfuss.
Mr. President, I saw somebody else rising, so.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, I don't think the task is nearly as onerous. This is just a very first look at it when you look at what we're talking about. There are guidelines, I think, already that can be used. I would suggest that we defeat this particular amendment, and if you're concerned about the time being too tight, give the bill an immediate effective date. That won't do any harm, so they'll just tell him officially to get started a little early, and then give him another couple of months to do it. Put the due date of the report off to November 1st. That'll give plenty of time for us to get the kind of first reconnaissance of what we're looking at, which is what we're really after here. And I think that would solve the problem in a good deal better fashion than this. Let's ignore the problem that we really do have with the local governments, because they sure seem to me in committee to be welcoming of getting some assistance in this area.
Senator Meyer.
President. Well, Mr. President, if you've got to look at this, this includes boards and commissions, and you've got some boards and commissions that may only meet once or twice, maybe four times a year. Talks about irrigation districts will probably be pulled into this. This is a time period where these folks are more interested about delivering water and growing crops than they are about the CIO coming in for data management consultation. And, you know, in some of the data there, is all public data anyway in a lot of these boards and commissions. There's not a lot of things that are out there that are actually would be classified as need to have data security. And in the long run, the chances of hacking occurring in these situations where they may not even have any access to the Internet for their files, that's probably the best data security you can have, is not to be accessed for the Internet, and a lot of these folks aren't on that in the first place. And I'm talking primarily about the boards and commissions and some of the smaller governments. So, Mr. President, I think this is a reasonable thing to do, is to walk, don't run into this, get our state house in order, use that as a template to move out to the areas where some of the larger cities, the larger counties could start implementing it, and do it in a logical, progressive manner without a huge expenditure of time or funds. So I think this is a good amendment, Mr. President. I would hope the body would support it. And let's move on with the process on our terms as to what the state can do. And maybe a third reading or second reading amendment, or whatever would be in order to include some of the larger municipalities that have in place already some data management and data security protocols. I think that could be accomplished within that time period. But this massive attack to draw everybody in, Mr. President, I think is probably a little bit like beating the whole thing with a fire hose. It's going to be extremely difficult, Mr. President.
Senator Rothfuss.
Mr. Chairman, for my first time on and against this amendment, Mr. Chairman, the first thing I'd like to point out is simply to remind the body that the State Chief Information Officer is a participant and member of this Digital Information Privacy Task Force and was supportive of this from the standpoint of whether logistically this could be done in a meaningful way by the deadline that's presented. The reason that deadline is a little bit early, the September 1st, is the way this task force operates is it can't sponsor its own legislation. So it's to try and provide some convenience to the committees that would then end up having to hear this after the task force drafts the legislation. So we have an earlier timeline in most of the work that we bring so that we can conclude work of the task force and then still have time to work with the committees on any changes or alterations or additional information that they need. That's the reason for what appears to be a short fuse between July 1st and the September 1st time frame. That said, if this legislation does pass, the expectation would be this process would begin informally before that with recognition that a lot of consultation would have to be done. And to the extent that many members of counties, cities, towns, and political subdivisions have already been involved in the task force, are aware of this process, and welcome this process, it would just be a natural progression of work that's already begun and moving forward. So it's a good product. It's a good start down a path. The idea that there'd be an expectation that every political subdivision board commission would have to weigh in and would be required is certainly not intended or expressed in this language. It's largely based on interest, Mr. President, and trying to be involved. I would say, though, that the counter language, where if we wanted to eliminate, for example, other political subdivisions, would be worse as a process forward, because it would say that the CIO would not have to ask some of the boards and commissions what they thought or weigh in or take their input into consideration. And I would suspect that this body would want a well-researched product before it was brought to the Digital Information Privacy Task Force and before any recommendations were made. And the final point, Mr. President, that I would say before hopefully we just get an action on this amendment would be this is seeking information. This is a quest for information that is not onerous. The only tasked entity is the Chief Information Officer, who goes into this willingly, recognizing that it's a good endeavor for the state to try and move us forward on our information management and privacy. And to that extent, there's really nothing to fear here. There's no boogeyman. Hopefully we can resist this amendment and get some good work done.
Further discussion?
Question.
Question having been called for, all those in favor of second reading amendment number 1 to Senate File 38, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
That amendment has failed. We're back on the bill. Any further discussion on the bill? There being none, Senate File 38 having been read 2 separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. Senate File 59, second reading of the bill.
Senate File 59, Deferred Compensation Automatic Enrollment Amendments 2.
There are no amendments. Any discussion? There being none. Senate File 59 having been read 2 separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. We're at that order of business of bills on third reading and final passage. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, do you have a consent list?
Mr. President, yes, we do. I have moved the third reading consent list for the following Senate files. Senate File 7, Landfill Remediation Priority List. Senate File 8, Bicycle and Pedestrian System Task Force. Senate File 14, Student Data Privacy and Transparency. Senate File 21, Mineral Tax Archaic Provisions. Senate File 23, NRC Agreement State Amendment. Senate File 30, Initiative Review Process. Senate File 33, Vehicle Registration Shell Businesses. Senate File 43, Workforce Investment Act Statutory Reference Amendment. Senate File 44, Obsolete Statutory Language Health Care. Senate File 47, Juvenile Sex Offender Risk Assessment. Senate File 49, Direct Primary Care Insurance Exemption. And Senate File 56, Dietitian Reimbursement.
Would any of the members like any of the bills withdrawn from the consent list? Senator Wasserberger.
Senate File 14, Student Data Privacy and Transparency.
Senate File 14, Student Data Privacy and Transparency, is removed from the consent list. Are there any other requests to remove any of these bills from the consent list? There being none. Senator Meyer.
File 8, the bicycle paths.
Senate File 8, bicycle paths and pedestrian systems is removed from the consent list. Any further bills? The following bills having been read two separate times, the question is, shall these bills be read? That's not the right script. Thank you. Having been read three separate times, the question is, shall these bills pass the Senate? Senate File 7, Landfill Remediation Priority List. Senate File 21, Mineral Tax Archaic Provisions. Senate File 23, NRC Agreement State Amendments. Senate File 30, Initiative Review Process. Senate File 33, Vehicle Registration Shell Businesses. Senate File 43, Workforce Investment Act Statutory Reference Amendments. Senate File 44, Obsolete Statutory Language Health Care. Senate File 47, Juvenile Sex Offender Risk Assessment. Senate File 49, Direct Primary Care Insurance Exemption. Senate File 56, Dietitian Reimbursement. Roll call.
On the consent list, Anderson.
Aye.
Barnard.
Aye.
Bebout.
Aye.
Boner.
Aye.
Burns.
Pardon me, let me give you a microphone, Senator Case.
I'm so sorry, but I know I shouldn't interrupt vote, but shouldn't she read the vote? Like we've been doing.
Sorry. I got carried away.
Okay.
Is it okay to restart?
Just go ahead and restart.
Okay.
It'll be fine.
Anderson?
Aye.
Aye. Barnard?
Aye.
Aye. Bebout?
Aye.
Aye. Boner?
Aye.
Aye. Burns?
Aye.
Aye. Case?
Aye.
Aye. Christensen?
Aye.
Aye. Coe?
Aye.
Aye. Cooper?
Aye.
Aye. Kraft?
Aye.
Aye. Dockstetter?
Aye.
Aye. Driscoll?
Aye.
Aye. Emmerich?
Aye.
Escobel?
Aye.
Aye. Geis?
Aye.
Aye. Hastert?
Aye.
Aye. Hicks?
Aye.
Aye. Johnson?
Aye.
Aye. Kinski?
Aye.
Aye. Landon?
Aye.
Aye. Meyer? Aye. Pappas?
Aye.
Aye. Perkins?
Aye.
Aye. Peterson?
Aye.
Aye. Ross?
Aye.
Aye. Rothfuss?
Aye.
Aye. Scott?
Aye.
Aye. Von Platern?
Aye.
Aye. Wasserberger?
Aye.
Aye. President Nicholas?
Aye.
Aye. On the consent list, 30 aye. Senate File 7, are there any changes? Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. Senate File 7, 30 aye. Senate File 21, are there any changes? Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. Senate File 21, 30 aye. Senate File 23, are there any changes? Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. Senate File 23, 30 ayes. Senate File 30, are there any changes? Case, aye to no. Burns, aye to no. Meyer, Aye to no. Closing vote. Closing vote closed. Senate File 30, 27 aye, 3 no. Senate File 33, are there any changes? Rothfuss, aye to no. Kraft, aye to no. Case, aye to no. I'm sorry. Hastert, aye to no. Pappas, aye to no.
Nicholas, aye to no.
Nicholas, aye to no. Perkins, aye to no. Closing vote. Closing vote closed. Senate File 33, 23 aye, 7 no. Senate File 43, are there any changes? Closing vote. Closing vote closed. Senate File 43, 30 aye. Senate File 44, are there any changes? Closing vote. Closing vote closed. Senate File 44, 30 aye. Senate File 47, are there any changes? Closing vote. Closing vote closed. Senate File 47, 30 aye. Senate File 49, are there any changes? Closing vote. Closing vote closed. Senate File 49, 30 aye. Senate File 56, are there any changes? Closing vote. Meyer, aye to no. Closing vote. Closing vote closed. Senate File 56, 29 aye, 1 no.
Having received the affirmative vote of the majority of the members elected to the Senate, Senate File 7, 21, 23, 30, 33, 43, 44, 47, 49, and 56 have passed the Senate. Senate File 8, third reading of the bill.
Senate File 8, Bicycle and Pedestrian System Task Force, sponsored by the Travel Commission, an act relating to highway, bicycle, and pedestrian safety.
Senator Meyer.
I'm wearing my helmet and my elbow guards and my shin guards and my hand guards to testify against this bill. Frankly, I think this is something the Department of Transportation can do anyway. There's, I think, some federal funds out there, and a lot of the cities and towns have already done this. I think it can be a voluntary thing. If the governor thinks it's a good idea, I think, I think he can be lobbied. It's not that I don't think it's a bad idea. It's just that I think that it's, as I said, the camel's nose under the tent. It's a new program. It's going to end up costing the state probably a lot of money if this goes forward, and I think this is basically a preemptive strike. Just time to do it.
Yeah. Further discussion on the bill. Senator Cooper.
Mr. President, as far as the transportation folks being able to do this bill, they testified in our committee that they could not do many of the things that this task force can do. For example, they can do the design and look at design parameters and look at the federal money possibly that's coming in, but they cannot do any of the economic development work. They can't do any of the local government work that they had, and they cannot do any of the tourism work that's in this bill. So it's critical for these small communities. The one thing about this bill that, or this task force that does, it is assist these small communities with these bicycle pass systems. One of the things that it particularly helps them with, if you're a very, very small rural community, you could still have a, and develop these pass systems within your community just by getting some help from the work that this task force could do, which they could not normally do or even afford to do. This is a, it doesn't cost us anything. This is, well, this is a part of the department's cost and all those things they do, plus we have many volunteers. This was the most, probably the most popular bill that our committee ever, I think, worked on. Every committee that we, every one of the meetings that we worked on this bill, we had packed sessions of people that were so interested, not only from just people who were bicyclists, but from local governments, from even government agencies, and all the associated federal agencies that were concerned. So it was a very, very popular bill, my friends.
Senator Case.
Mr. President, thank you very much. I think we kind of have to look at this a little bit different as well, because, you know, our citizenry really has changed. And the way they enjoy and love Wyoming is perhaps slightly different than the way we did. They look for livable communities. And it, and how livable a community is as important to recruiting a company or a person to come live in your community as anything else. What do they like in that community? Well, they like, certainly they like, you know, the amenities that, that government provides, and they like the opportunities for recreation. Back, bike paths are a huge piece of this. And you can see differences in Wyoming from communities that have successfully been able to do this, some located in areas that have more local wealth, perhaps, or local ability to raise money and put these paths in. And, you know, it's really kind of important now when you're recruiting folks to come and live. They want they love the outdoor aspect of Wyoming, but they want enough infrastructure that they can ride their bikes safely and not be in conflict with cars. It's a little different than when we were kids, you know, and you got on the deal and you didn't have a helmet and you just went down and went to school and that was it, locked your bike up or maybe not, got stolen probably, mine did several times, run home, dodge cars all the way in potholes. It's not like that now. There are, people don't put their kids on bikes unless it's safe. They have helmets. They worry about where they ride. They worry about how they ride. They have outings on bike paths. They want it to be safe and not interfering with traffic. It's different now. Let's recognize that difference. It's very important to the new people that we're going to have come to Wyoming and live here.
I guess that explains why Bob Nicholas had so many bikes in the House. Senator Cole.
Mr. President, in support of the bill, you know, we don't have a lot of good things happening right now in Wyoming. Mineral industry, we all know about that, but I can tell you that tourism is doing quite well. And this is a component of the inventory of tourism that will help bring people to the state of Wyoming. I agree with everything the good senator from Fremont County over there said as well. Livable communities, what makes communities attractive for economic development for people to move in. But bicycle tourism is huge and getting bigger and bigger. And Senate File 8 will enhance that, and I urge that the Senate support it.
For discussion, Senator Christensen.
Mr. President, thank you. Now, as a, in my former life as a county commissioner, I saw how the costs of these can really escalate. And that is something you want to go into with your eyes wide open. However, I've also seen how people make their biggest choices quite often in their life when it comes to purchases on buying real estate and homes, and it's tied to pathway systems. It's very important to a lot of people that they're able to go out on a place for themselves, for their kids, and this has some value. We do need to be careful and keep a close eye on the way the money rolls, but the opportunities that could, that we may discover that don't involve large spendings, I think are worthy of this task force. In our community, we had a young lady run over and killed in an area where it was slow-speed traffic. We had another man that was out riding his bike on the shoulder of the road, on a big wide road, that was hit and killed. And those kind of things, it only happens a few times, and folks start to become very careful. And those pathways do make a difference. They are expensive, and depending on how they're developed, they may be a luxury. But give communities the option to have the conversation and a little bit of organization and support from the states. I think it's time well spent.
Further discussion on the bill?
Question
has been called for. Roll call.
Anderson?
Aye.
Aye. Barnard?
Aye.
Aye. Bebout?
Aye.
Aye. Boner?
Aye.
Aye. Burns?
Aye.
Aye. Case?
Aye.
Aye. Christensen?
Aye.
Aye. Coe?
Aye.
Aye. Cooper?
Aye.
Aye. Kraft?
Aye.
Aye. Dockstetter?
Aye.
Aye. Driscoll?
Aye.
Aye. Emmerich?
Aye.
Aye. Escobel?
Aye.
Geis?
Aye.
Aye. Hastert?
Aye.
Aye. Hicks?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Aye. Kinski?
Aye.
Aye. Landon?
Aye.
Aye. Meyer?
No.
No. Pappas?
Aye.
Aye. Perkins?
No.
No. Peterson?
Aye.
Aye. Ross?
Aye.
Aye. Rothfuss?
Aye.
Aye. Scott?
Aye.
Aye. Von Platern?
Aye.
Aye. Wasserberger?
No.
No. President Nicholas?
Aye.
Aye. Closing vote?
Hicks, aye to no.
Hicks, aye to no. Closing vote? Closing vote closed. 26 aye, 4 no.
Set file 8 having received the affirmative vote of the majority of members elected to the Senate, Senate file 8 has passed the Senate. Senate file 14. Third reading of the bill.
Senate File 14, Student Data Privacy and Transparency, sponsored by the Education Committee, an act relating to education.
Senator Wasserberger.
Thank you, Mr. President. I would rise against Senate File 14 and ask you to vote no. And I'm going to walk you through this bill if I can. And one of the things that I've done as a principal and as an administrator is I served on the faculty for South Dakota State University as an adjunct professor, and I taught young teachers who were getting their master's degree in administration. And the course was called School Law. And so we're going to talk to you a little bit about what school law says. Essentially, what this bill does is it gives a constitutional protection to students for digital information. And over the years, you know, as a building principal, I've had a number of students get in trouble, and I may have even violated this law. And the paradigm shift in this bill is that we're going to punish our school administrators by saying that if they do this, if they violate constitutional rights of students, then now they're going to have a $250 fine, and for each subsequent act, it will be $1,000. And that's a paradigm shift in the history of this state. We've never ever done that before, and so I caution you to vote aye on this bill. And the law that we're talking about is common law. It's called in loco parentis. An in loco parentis means that a principal acts in the place of a parent. And I don't think that any of us in this room doesn't think that they, as a parent, have the right to look at their child's email, their Facebook, their Twitter account, their text, and their pictures on their phones. And so I caution you on this issue. And I take that in local parentis very much so. And I take it so much that if a gunman walks into my school and I live through that, I didn't act like a parent. I better put myself between that gun and those students, because that's what a parent would do. And so keeping your school safe is the most important thing that we do. And keeping it drug-free. This morning we had testimony that just tore your guts out. Let's take that situation. A student comes into my office and says, I think your teacher is having an affair with a student. Really? I better move. I've got something to do. I call that student down. Hey, this is what I heard. Can you tell me about that? He says, yeah. I said, I want to look at your email. And so I take that email, I start reading it. By the end of the day, I call that teacher down, I terminate that teacher. And if I violated that student's rights, you could have two things go wrong. You could have the teacher being charged with having sex with a minor, which is a fairly severe penalty. And then I could be charged because I violated their constitutional rights, but I acted like a parent. And so I caution you on this bill. Guidance counselors have issues coming into their office all the time. All the time. And they are required by our law to report any child abuse. What happens if they violate the student's constitutional rights? Are we going to charge them with $250 and $1,000 every time after that? Think carefully about where you're going on this bill. The biggest Supreme Court decision on this issue is called PLO versus New Jersey. And in that case, went all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And it established that TLO was selling drugs in their school. And the principal brought the young lady into his office and searched her purse. And the next thing he sees, he finds cigarettes. He finds a lighter. He finds a list that says, people who owe me money. And then he finds a small bud of marijuana. He calls the parents. He calls the police.
Time.
He goes to the juvenile system. Time? Okay. And I'll take my second later.
Thank you. Senator Kinski.
Mr. President, rising on and against the bill, I can echo the same sentiments as the senator from Campbell County. I've heard the same things from my school district. They have an obligation to avoid abuse. They have an obligation to put a stop to what is called cyberbullying, new to all of us, but very familiar to the kids. They have an obligation to investigate and stop sexting, which is very all alien to us, but new to this environment with these kids. So they are concerned that how do they fulfill that obligation properly to those children in light of this bill, and they've expressed very strong reservation about it. If we could briefly just walk back in history, there was a time in America where the parents exactly did act in loco parentis, and then there was the pendulum swung the other way, and they started introducing due process, constitutional due process into the schools where you couldn't expel a kid without having lawyering up and having all kinds of hearings. You couldn't discipline them without having all this procedural due process. And that brought what was once an orderly discipline in the schools to a halt. And gradually, with pushback, that all got reversed. There is still protection for students, but certainly not the level that there once was, where any kind of discipline with a child meant everybody was lawyering up. And this bill, in my estimate, is a step backwards. Instead of the administrators doing what is right and in the best interest of the children, Now they've got to call a lawyer before they can investigate cyberbullying or investigate sexting to make sure they're not crossing over the line. I would urge a negative vote on the bill. Thank you, Mr. President.
Senator Dockstader.
Thank you, Mr. President. I was thinking about the value of all the committee work, all the work that goes into it, and I do appreciate that, but there is that's probably why we run it through through the committees and the preparation and the interim and the three-reading process, because somewhere along the way you start to get a better feel for where you're at. And I don't know why I couldn't rest easy on this one as I sat down, and I was trying to respect all the work that had been done. I'd watched it, agreed to some extent, but then I started thinking about individual instances and problems. We had an instance where we were able to derail something before it got too serious. It actually stopped something that could have been much worse just because we had access to the electronic information. And the bullying part, that's been something that I've become more aware of, having family involved in education, and I realize just how that's so prevailed in the past. We've actually passed legislation on that very issue, not on the electronic side, but bullying in our schools. So electronically, that's part of the problem there, too. So, in summary, aren't we supposed to keep our schools safe? Shouldn't we be able to access all the information we can to keep our schools safe? We can pass pieces of legislation to keep our schools safe. But ultimately, in this world of electronics, where the youth are picking up these iPads and these phones and using them, don't we have an overriding obligation to keep our schools safe and have access to that information? So I've probably done a turnaround on this one. It hasn't been easy because I saw all the work that went into it, Mr. President, a lot of work. But at this point, I think ultimately our ultimate goal is to keep our schools safe and to keep our students out of situations that could not only lead them or adults into the wrong, into a difficult situation. So I'd stand against the bill.
Discussion on the bill, Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, on for the bill, but you know, these are all very serious issues that are being raised and discussed, and there are certainly things that we talked through in the Digital Information Privacy Task Force, and we didn't take the line we drew lightly because of that. We had excellent testimony from school administrators and from folks that had the very same concerns and carefully drafted the legislation to try and address those concerns. There's a few things that obviously have to be recognized. The first, which is always the case, is that privacy rights are inconvenient under any circumstance when you're doing an investigation, not just for kids, for adults as well. And it's always difficult to draw that line because whenever we have, as the government, the opportunity to invade somebody's privacy, to look at their personal files, to look at their personal materials, to look at letters they've sent, their own digital information, communications, we're always better off from a law enforcement standpoint. That there's no question about that. I can't argue that. I can't argue that if we just know everything, if we can just get a little bit more Big Brother, then we can prevent something from happening that might not otherwise happen. I can't deny that. I wish I could. I wish I had an argument against that and could stand up to my good friend from the northern part of the state on that and say, no, you're wrong, that there's no way we would prevent anything additional. But that's not a reasonable position to take, because the reality is if we know everything that everyone's doing, we'll probably stop a few things. But that's not our only value. We're not only about trying to stop bad things from happening. We are also a state and a society that feels very strongly about the privacy rights of individuals. And those privacy rights have changed and evolved over the years. And I appreciate the fact that my friend taught law on this to schools. But the case to which he refers was a 1985 law. And there have been, or excuse me, not law, but Supreme Court decision. And there have been numerous Supreme Court decisions since that time that have upheld the privacy rights of individuals, even in schools with regard to cell phones. That includes U.S. District Court decisions. It includes a Supreme Court decision, which was not specific to children, but goes to and entirely changes the meaning of a cell phone in the Riley decision in 2014, where they say a cell phone, for example, has so much private material on it that's not just the individual's private material, but private information about others that just happens to be on there, that the Supreme Court decided for the first time to treat that cell phone entirely different than they ever had before. It was just way too much of a privacy invasion for this court to accept. So they changed things. And that's the world we live in, is having to draw new lines, and that's what the Digital Information Privacy Task Force was trying to look at. So the line we decided at the end of it all was the parent. The parent is the key to how we drew the line. We said that a school representative, a school administrator, a teacher, does not have the right to compel a student to disclose private information, but they do have the right to call in that parent and say, you know what, we need to know this because it's really important to us for these reasons, cyberbullying, a threat, an imminent danger, any of these types of things. That was how we decided we could get the law, the privacy, and everything else respected, and try to ensure that we never held back the interests of the schools. We do make it a little bit more challenging. There's no question about it. It's easier if the teacher can just walk up to the student and say, give me your cell phone, give me your password, otherwise you're suspended. They have to do that. And then I can look through all of their email. That's the other thing. These are not law enforcement personnel that are carefully scrutinized and limited in the rights that they're going to have. When law enforcement would look at some material, they would be bound by their professional conduct that they actually have to adhere to and maybe the court warrant to look at specific information. We currently don't have that for the schools. It really is a give me your password. I'm going to look at your summer vacation photos for a while. I'm going to look at your friends' private photos of the party last week, which wasn't even something that was reported to me, but believe me, now I see what Billy was doing after school last week, and that's kind of interesting to me also. All of those things are what start to happen, and that's not something we're shooting for. But again, if you bring the parents into it, Mr. President, and have them always on the hook, we can get to the same interests that my friend raised, make sure that we're heading off any of those bad circumstances that we do want the school to help us to avoid in loco parentis, but at the same time respecting the very important privacy rights of our young students. And those privacy rights are real. We like to dismiss the rights of children because it's inconvenient for them to have those rights. But I don't want my children's rights dismissed in loco parentis. I do not want the schools to believe that they can simply take my children's cell phone, look through all their private material, and do as they see fit. This is a good piece of legislation that's well drafted. I urge support.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. President, I'll be brief. And I struggled with this bill in committee. And after looking at some of the testimony, I've got one of the concerns. And my biggest concern is it doesn't specify the age of the child here. And so I'm becoming increasingly concerned with the fact that the idea that an 18-year-old can have reasonable thoughts and processes and understand sexting or texting or whatever the heck all this stuff that goes in. But we're now saying that 12, 13, 14-year-olds, almost every kid has a cell phone nowadays. They have some type of digital account to the point where we're now saying that irresponsible behavior of some of our youngest children in the school system is now protected. And I just wonder, as I question the sponsor of the bill, with several scenarios, one of the things that came up was, as well, a responsible teacher would act. It's only going to cost them $250 because they've been fined. What happens if they do it again? Pretty soon they've got two misdemeanors on their record, and they're doing it for all the right reasons. All those things that you would want a teacher to intervene to save your school, a mass shooting, sexual abuse, all these things that you would want those teachers to be involved in, we've now said, well, a responsible teacher would do it, but you're a criminal, pay the fine, goes on your record, and hopefully you don't lose your job. So I'm not concerned about the 17 and the 18-year-olds. I'm concerned about those 11 and those 12 and those 13-year-olds that don't have a rational mind, folks. You trust those teachers every day with your kids. If we can't trust them to use a little discretion and a little common sense, on what is appropriate to look at in a student's email, then we might as well get rid of the teachers.
Further discussion on the bill. Further discussion on the bill. Senator Wasserberger, for your second and final time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to go back and discuss the landmark case of New Jersey versus TLO, which established the issue of reasonable suspicion. And that's always been the standard that administrators are required to have. That's all I need is reasonable suspicion to do almost anything. And here we're actually making that standard much higher. So we're actually going to give rights to students. And at the risk of embarrassing my school district, I will tell you this story. A number of years ago, I had a boy come into my office and say, Mr. Wasserberger, I think so-and-so has nude pictures on his phone. Really? Well, let's make sure let's check on that. And we'll do that within the next 15 minutes. We call the young man down. He comes into my office. I say, hey, I understand that you have nude pictures on your phone. Is that true? Let me see your phone. What's your password? Before it was all over, he had enticed 5 girls in our school to send him nude pictures of them. We sat down with his parent. I said, this is your son's phone? That's correct. He has nude pictures on his phone. I said, we're going to sit down with every female student's parents, and we're going to delete these. And he's going to delete them in front of you. And we did that. At the end of the day, I would turn to the mom or the dad of the daughter, and I would say, is this your daughter? I never looked at the pictures. And they said, yes. I said to the kid, take him off your phone now. By the end of the day, we had everybody solved, and we went on. Guess what? Then he can call the police. Police comes in, gives me a citation. I get fined $250 for the first one. I get fined $1,000 for every time after that. On and against the bill.
Question on the bill. Please call roll call.
Anderson?
No.
No. Barnard?
No.
No. Bebout?
No.
No. Boner?
No.
No. Burns?
No.
No. Case?
Aye.
Aye. Christensen?
No.
No. Coe?
Aye.
Aye. Cooper?
No.
No. Kraft?
Aye.
Aye. Dockstetter?
No.
No. Driscoll?
No.
Emmerich?
Aye.
Aye. Esquivel?
Aye.
Aye. Geis?
No.
No. Hastert?
Aye.
Aye. Hicks?
No.
No. Johnson?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Kinski?
No.
No. Landon?
Aye.
Aye. Meyer?
Aye.
Aye. Pappas?
Aye.
Aye. Perkins?
Aye.
Aye. Peterson? No. Ross?
Aye.
Aye. Rothfuss?
Aye.
Aye. Scott?
No.
No. Von Fladern?
No.
No. Wasserberger?
No.
No. President Nicholas?
No.
No. Closing vote? Closing vote closed. 13 aye, 17 no.
Senate File 14, having failed to receive affirmative vote of the majority of the members elected to the Senate, Senate File 14 has failed to pass the Senate. Senate File 20, third reading of the bill.
Senate File 20, Sales and Use Tax Remedy Revision, sponsored by Senator Peterson, an act relating to sales and use tax.
We have amendments. Would you please, with the reading clerk, please read in the first reading, or the third reading, amendment number one.
Senate File 20, third reading, amendment number one, page one, line one.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move third reading amendment number one. Senate File 20 asks for the body's favorable consideration Mr. President, we go into the bill in four different places. It's essentially the same language. The reason you go in four places is because you've got tax credits and tax refunds. Essentially, what this amendment, what these amendments do, and all of them provide for rules and regulations of the department to implement the changes here. And it puts a burden to pay back the taxpayer to the department. Essentially, it says, tells the vendor if they made a mistake, they notify their department as what the circumstances were. The department investigates what the circumstances were, and they make reasonable efforts to reimburse the overpayment to the taxpayer or the refund or the credit or what the specific case was. So, Mr. President, that is it in a nutshell. It changes it in the bill. The problem that I had was, and frankly, I don't trust government, and that's why I'm making this change, because it tells the vendor that you've made an erroneous payment, you tell the department, and then you're supposed to pay back the taxpayer and then seek reimbursement from the department. Well, the department really hasn't said, okay, we're going to pay you back if you pay them, everything is right, you made the mistake, and we know that, and the money's right here, and you write your check and send it to them, you get this one back, then the guy doesn't get paid. I don't know how many times that people have dealt with governments and not gotten paid in circumstances where it was just a little bit cloudy. And this makes it real clear, is that there's the investigation, and even though the vendor made this mistake in the first time, he owned up to it, and the department investigates and makes sure that the guy actually did make a mistake. And if they did make a mistake, then they make reasonable efforts to get the money back to the taxpayer. And that's what it does, Mr. President. I hope we have a favorable consideration.
Discussion on the amendment. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. President. I certainly appreciate the sponsor of this amendment's efforts and intention, but be careful. This could be a rabbit hole that, you know, it was good enough to show me the amendment and mention it to me, and I've been reading it over, and the thought keeps coming back to me. The department was not the ones that made the erroneous collection, but yet we're putting the burden back on the department to track these taxpayers down, to mail them a reimbursement. Now, granted, it might be most likely the larger purchased items, the larger amount, dollar amount purchased items, but what if a taxpayer, a customer, comes back to the vendor, files a complaint, not by the vendor, but by the taxpayer, and that burden now is placed on the department to reimburse 100, 200, 300 people, 400, 500, I don't know, you know, 50 cents or $1.50. So that $96,000 that the department has given back to reimburse the vendors since this ruling from the board, we now increase that with the mailing costs and the time and the effort when it wasn't their mistake in the first place. So I likewise have some concerns about government, and but in this case, they were not the ones that were guilty of erroneously collecting the tax. They're trying to enforce it. We're trying to close a loophole. Again, keep our eye on the ball. I'd urge your vote no against this amendment.
Further discussion on the amendment? For your second and final time, Senator Meyer.
Well, we're only talking about $96,000 here in the first place, and I'm assuming the reason we have this bill here is because you have some vendors that aren't reimbursing the taxpayers. Well, that's a pretty simple fix for the department. They just no longer have a sales tax authority. There's your fix. The fix is out there even without a bill. They just tell the guy, hey, we're pulling your sales tax number because you're not playing by the rules. And you know what the rules are. The rules are is that if we give you money, you're supposed to pay the guy. And we can find out pretty easy whether you pay the guy or don't pay the guy. There's really no reason for the bill, Mr. President. But if we're going to have a bill, let's make sure that the bill's going to be functioning, and we know that the money's going to be going to the taxpayer. So if there's a necessity to say that you have some funds that just aren't worth looking at, then, you know, we could probably have an amendment that would say that if it wasn't $10 or more or something like that, then these little frivolous things would go away. But really, there really isn't any need for the bill in the first place. But if you do have the bill, there's a couple of amendments here. This is one. There's another one. Let's get those passed and get in halfway decent order.
We're on third reading amendment number one to Senate File 20. The question having been called for, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
That amendment has failed. We're on... Would the reading clerk please read in third reading amendment number two?
Senate File 20, third reading amendment number two, page 2, line 20.
Senator Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move for adoption of amendment number two to Senate File 20 and urge your adoption. This bill was extensively debated in committee, and one of the real problems we came up with is what happens if you're refunding, because what's reasonable, that's all the bill says now, is what is reasonable. And what happens if somebody that cuts coupons thinks that a 15-cent refund is reasonable, and it costs you, as we just talked about, $1 a piece to mail it out, plus the time it takes for bookkeeping to dig it out and do it. For that person, they may say it's reasonable. So what this amendment does is raise it to $10, which would be approximately a $150 purchase. So on the smaller items, basically what it says is you made a mistake. The bill goes ahead and transfers it on. The money does not go to you. You don't get rewarded as a vendor. It goes on to the Department of Revenue and goes back into the general fund. But it does make you refund that money, and what I'm setting this amount is $10 refund is a reasonable amount for you to go to the work to find that refund. If you're in a business that's, they brought it out, most of these happen in audits, and they do an audit and they find out you've been charging for bottled water, and the tax on it is 6 cents. And the day and age of computerized sales in a store, they can easily tell you to go back and tag that item back to all your through the computer, through all your sales, and refund it to your credit cards. You're going to talk about a dollar a transaction on this. You're going to have some vendors that literally come in and say, I give. And I think 10 is a reasonable amount. It makes it where you try to get it back. If you don't like the amount, I would hope that you try to move it to a different amount. But reasonable is really a hard thing to understand, or at least to me, because to one person, a dollar is not a lot of money, and to another person, a dollar is. So what's reasonable? Let's be reasonable, and let's put a set amount on it. I would move for adoption, please.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. President. I would rise against the amendment. You know, I think it's going to work itself out with the department. I think in some instances, if you overcharge me $10 on a credit card purchase, charge me taxes when I shouldn't have been, I think that's a lot of money. I think that's worth the effort to try to refund it to be honest. But it goes to the gentleman's point, I think, that reasonableness might be in the eye of the beholder. But, you know, I think that's a big one. And I think we better let the department work this out over time. It sort of depends on what you're selling, whether it's paid in cash or not, whether there's a record of the vendors or the record of the purchaser, which many, many times there won't be. So I'm willing to trust the department on this. I suggest that the $10 is, man, that's a lot of money. If they overcharge you $10 and when they shouldn't have charged the tax, and they did, they have your address on the credit card, they can refund it through the system, I think they should. $10 is a bunch.
Further discussion, Senator Driscoll, for your second time.
Thank you. Once again, I'd urge you to vote for it. This doesn't give the
department the flexibility. When you look at this bill, we didn't give them the flexibility. We said reasonable in the bill, and that doesn't say the department says reasonable. It says reasonable. You're going to end up with somebody in court, and this body's going to find out what reasonable is, because that really does not say who gets to say what reasonable is. And I would guess the good friends of mine that are lawyers in this crowd have argued that over divorce cases is a lot of people think one thing's reasonable and another one doesn't. Let's really be careful what we're doing here. We've got a lot of burdens on these vendors. The other thing I'll tell you, they're not taking this tax and stealing it. They're not doing it on purpose. These are accidental charges. They've already had them show up. The department's found them. They showed up. And what this bill does is make sure that they don't get rewarded for taking that money. It takes the money and it gives it back to the department and says there's no motive for you to go take money away from somebody. It's accidental. So let's not punish somebody unmercifully over an accident. I urge adoption.
Question been called for on third reading amendment number 2 to Senate File 20. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
The questions, the chairs in doubt, division having been called for. All those in favor, please stand. Those opposed, please stand. Seventeen, the amendments failed. We're back on the bill. Any further discussion on the bill? If not, roll call on the bill.
Anderson?
Aye.
Aye. Barnard?
Aye.
Aye. Bebout?
No.
No. Boner?
Aye.
Aye. Burns?
Aye.
Aye. Case?
Aye.
Aye. Christensen?
Aye.
Aye. Co?
Aye.
Aye. Cooper?
Aye.
Aye. Kraft?
Aye.
Aye. Dockstetter?
Aye.
Aye. Driscoll?
No.
No. Emmerich?
Aye.
Aye. Escobel?
Aye.
Geis?
No.
No. Hastert?
Aye.
Aye. Hicks?
Aye.
Aye. Johnson?
No.
No. Kinski?
No.
No. Landon?
Aye.
Aye. Meyer?
No.
Pappas?
Aye.
Aye. Perkins?
Aye.
Aye. Peterson?
Aye.
Aye. Ross?
Aye.
Aye. Rothfuss?
Aye.
Aye. Scott?
Aye.
Von Platern?
Aye.
Aye. Wasserberger?
Aye.
Aye. President Nicholas?
Aye.
Aye. Closing vote. Closing vote closed. 24 aye, 6 no.
Senate File 20, having received the affirmative vote of the majority of the members elected to the Senate, Senate File 20 has passed the Senate. Senate File 28, third reading of the amendment. Or the bill.
Senate File 28, Carbon Capture, Storage, and Sequestration Permit, sponsored by the Minerals Committee. An act relating to environmental quality.
We have amendments. Would the reading clerk please read in the First Amendment?
Senate File 28, Third Reading, Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 22.
Senator Von Platern.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move third reading amendment number 1 to Senate File 28 and ask for your aye vote on this. What I've learned during this amendment was that we're dealing with the DEQ, the statutes that deal with DEQ, and I was mixing up with the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, which has what I did was I put the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission in as the final say on a decision made by another department, which is the Department of Environmental Quality. So what this does is if you ever get into the Class 6 wells, you automatically have the EQC, the Environmental Quality Control
Council.
Or Council, excuse me, sir, Council to make your appeal to if you really think there's an issue with the decision to keep it a Type 2 well versus a Type 6 permit. So that decision and that public appeal process is already in place. So what this does is delete my last amendment, except for that very first part of the last amendment, which was wording given to us by the Oil and Gas Commission, which said the supervisor and talks about his regulations and also leaves the word consider in there and deletes that the director of the Department of Environmental Quality will make his basis determination on what the commission, Oil and Gas Commission, comes up with. So all this does is it deletes everything I said about the public appeal aspect of what that last amendment would do. If you don't like the decision by the department, you always have the Environmental Quality Council to appeal to. So that appeal exists. I ask for your eye amendment, and I'll stand for questions.
Questions on the amendment?
Question.
If there's no further questions, the question is on third reading amendment number one to Senate File 28. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That amendment's been adopted. Would the reading clerk please read in the second amendment?
Senate File 28, third reading amendment number 2, page 2, line 21.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. President, I'd like to withdraw that second amendment to 28 since the chairman did such a great job with that first amendment. Thank you.
Third reading amendment number 2 has been withdrawn without objection. Any further discussion on the bill? There being none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Anderson?
Aye.
Aye. Barnard?
Aye.
Aye. Bebout?
Aye.
Aye. Boner?
Aye.
Aye. Burns?
Aye.
Aye. Case?
Aye.
Aye. Christensen?
Aye.
Aye. Coe?
Aye.
Aye. Cooper?
Aye.
Aye. Kraft?
Aye.
Aye. Dockstetter? Aye. Driscoll?
Aye.
Aye. Emmerich?
Aye.
Aye. Escobel?
Aye.
Aye. Geis?
Aye.
Aye. Hastert?
Aye.
Aye. Hicks?
Aye.
Aye. Johnson?
Aye.
Aye. Kinski?
Aye.
Aye. Landon?
Aye.
Aye. Meyer?
Aye.
Aye. Pappas?
Aye.
Aye. Perkins?
Aye.
Aye. Peterson?
Aye.
Aye. Ross?
Aye.
Aye. Rothfuss?
Aye.
Aye. Scott?
Aye.
Aye. Von Platern?
Aye.
Aye. Wasserberger?
Aye.
Aye. President Nicholas?
Aye.
Aye. Closing vote. Closing vote closed. 30 aye.
Senate File 28, having received the affirmative vote of the majority of the members elected to the Senate, Senate File 28 has passed the Senate. Senate File 36, third reading of the file.
Senate File 36, LLC member and manager liability, sponsored by the Corporations Committee, an act relating to limited liability companies.
Senator Chase.
Mr. President, before we get to the amendment, I'd like to request that this be laid over till Monday for third reading. It will screw up the members of the bar's weekend, and I think that would be worth doing.
Are there any objections to that? There being none, Senate File 36 is laid back for third reading until Monday. Senate File 57, third reading of the bill.
Senate File 57, Freestanding Emergency Center, sponsored by the Labor Committee, an act relating to public health and safety.
We have an amendment. Would the reading clerk please read in the amendment?
Senate File 57, third reading amendment number 1, page 2, before line 17.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, I move adoption of this amendment. Mr. President, as this bill's proceeded, the local hospital got nervous about a potential unintended consequence, and they contacted their delegation, who contacted me, and I've been trying to work with the experts that I can find, and let me explain the concern and explain what the amendment does about it. The concern is that if we get one of these freestanding emergency centers coming in over the border, as we might, that it might cost the local hospital here in Cheyenne its sole community provider status with Medicare. And that's a device that Medicare has to try to make up in part for the fact that they don't pay full cost for the services they have. They pay less than what it costs to provide those services. And that's trouble. They try to make that up in part, and it's a big deal. When my community lost its sole community provider status, I forget the exact figure of how many millions it cost the hospital, but it was millions. And I can understand why the hospital here is uptight about it. What the amendment does is makes it very clear this is a separate license from a hospital license. And the experts think that's all that's really required. Now, I think with the bill as it stands, that's the way the Department of Health would administer it. But this makes it very clear, says that a freestanding emergency center license is not a license to operate a hospital, and says that they can't hold a patient within the facility for more than 24 hours. And then this being Wyoming, where we have blizzards and such, we add the caveat, unless an emergency arises that prevents the safe transport of the patient. Whether and that's actually it's worded that way because the transport could be to home or it could be to some other hospital. So this is a precaution to make sure there isn't an unintended consequence to this bill. Mr. President, I think there's probably 9 chances out of 10 this precaution is unnecessary, but there's enough money at stake that I think we're much safer with it in here, and it will allay the fears locally here, and I can sure understand why they're scared given what the feds can do.
Question. Further questions on the amendment or discussion? There being none, the question is on third reading amendment number 1 to House Senate File 57. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That amendment has been adopted. We're back on the bill. Is there any further discussion on the bill? There being none, will the Chief Clerk please call the roll?
Anderson?
Aye.
Aye. Barnard?
Aye.
Aye. Bebout?
Aye.
Aye. Boner?
Aye.
Aye. Burns?
Aye.
Aye. Case?
Aye.
Aye. Christensen?
Aye.
Aye. Coe?
Aye.
Aye. Cooper?
Aye.
Aye. Kraft?
Aye.
Aye. Dockstetter?
Aye.
Aye. Driscoll?
Aye.
Aye. Emmerich?
Aye.
Aye. Escobel?
Aye.
Aye. Geis?
Aye.
Aye. Hastert?
Aye.
Aye. Hicks?
Aye.
Aye. Johnson?
Aye.
Aye. Kinski?
Aye.
Aye. Landon?
Aye.
Aye. Meyer? Meyer?
Aye.
Aye. Pappas?
Aye.
Perkins?
Aye.
Aye. Peterson?
Aye.
Aye. Ross?
Aye.
Aye. Rothfuss?
Aye.
Aye. Scott?
Aye.
Aye. Von Platern?
Aye.
Aye. Wasserberger?
Aye.
Aye. President Nicholas?
Aye.
Aye. Closing vote? Closing vote closed. 30 aye.
Senate File 57, having received the affirmative vote of the majority members elected to the Senate, Senate File 57 has passed the Senate. The next order of business is the adoption of rules. Before we get there, I think it's probably best to request that the chairman or the majority floor leader talk appropriations, discuss the plan for the budget. Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. President. members of the Senate, after meeting with leadership and staff this afternoon at lunch break, we have determined that it's best for us to start the budget on Monday. You have the budget, and you'll have the ability to view it over the weekend. We will begin general file on Monday. We'll go probably Monday, Tuesday, general file, and take a day off, do second reading. I believe that's the way it is. And then try to get done with the budget in this week. It frees up our staff. We have been burning our staff to death. And it gives them an opportunity so that they're not working every day, where they could take a breather maybe a little bit. But it also frees up some time for them to work on the conference committee or the differences between the House and the Senate over a weekend, and allows them a little bit more free time. And so having decided that, we wanted to make sure that you knew why, you know, the President had indicated we were probably going to start it on Tuesday. But really, it's a function of we're operating our staff. Normally, we have a staff of four. We're actually operating with three. And so we just need to be careful, and we need to protect them. And just an admonition, if you are going to be thinking about a lot of amendments, you know, be considerate of that, because there are some things as we move forward that because of the way in which we did particularly the general operations budget, it's line item by line item. So if you wanted to go in and do an amendment, say, for instance, we did a global amendment of 1% the first year and 2% the second year across agencies, what we call the penny plan. If you wanted to take that to, say, 5%, it is physically impossible for the staff to be able to do such an amendment. So it would probably go into a Section 300 amendment and a dollar figure. Okay, so just understand that's how we're going to proceed. Wanted to give you a fair warning so that over the weekend have an opportunity to review the budget bill. We will appropriations will be meeting in the morning to finalize our two final other bills to get them back to us, and that's the school capital construction bill and our state capital construction bill that we have separated out. So this is a new endeavor for everybody in the way in which we're doing this, because normally they were all combined into one bill. And given that we're doing it this way, some people I've heard complain. Some have said, well, how am I supposed to know? Is it confusing or whatnot? What we're trying to make as best as possible for you. If you have questions, please come and ask. And we'll do our best to make sure at the end of the day that everybody has a fair opportunity to examine the budget and to have your questions raised and have your amendments heard. Okay? So that's how we're going to handle it. And I defer to the President if there's anything further he'd like to say.
Well, if you were listening to me this morning, never mind. If you listen to public radio, never mind. Public TV, never mind. You know, one of the overriding issues has been our staff and how we utilize them. And when we left last evening, we believed that it would be better to give some staff some free time over the weekend. Over the evening and in meeting with staff today and then with leadership group together, what we concluded was, and what staff concluded is, the best time for them to work on the bill is over the weekend when folks aren't here, when it's quiet, and they can actually focus on it. And if we hang the budget over the weekend, then that means they're going to be doing the final bill itself during the weekdays. And the weekdays are so hectic and cluttered, and there are so many things to do, they just can't give it their undivided attention. And so while we were trying to get them another day off of the week, what this means is those staff are going to be working 7 days a week. But at least for them, the 2 days where they're drafting the bills each time will be done over the weekend when it's quiet and they can think. And I think that's the real driver that led us to the decision today to really change our mind from yesterday. I think folks had questions. Senator Christensen, did you have a question?
Not on this bill, not a different matter.
Okay. We're at that order of business of rules. The first rule for consideration, we're at that order of bill, the amending of the adoption of the rules. Mr. Majority Leader, do you have a list of the proposed amendments?
I do. Before I do, may I have privilege of the floor?
Yes, you may.
Thank you, Mr. President. A couple of things for the body. We are going to work general file today. Next week is going to be very busy, and I do not want to have us find ourselves in an opportunity that some of our Senate files don't get heard. If the House bill, I'd be a little different about it. I really didn't say that, but I did. But that's what we'll do. So we're going to work general file today, then the chairman of the Appropriations Committee mentioned he's going to work tomorrow. I think he meant Monday morning. So we're going to come in Monday at 10 o'clock to give the Appropriations Committee a chance to do their work. And with that, Mr. President, there are three rules that we're going to look at, Senate Rule 1, Senate Rule 2, and Joint Rule 1. And, Mr. President, I move Senate Rule Number 1 and ask that the Senate adopt this rule change. I'll be glad to explain it. Do you need to read it in?
Yes, please. I think so. Let's go ahead and have it read in.
Senate Rule 1, Senate Rule 4-1, by creating a new subsection B, is amended to read.
And, Mr. President, I again move Senate Rule Number 1. Members of the Senate, if you look at under the our rules of the Senate under 4.0, introduction and referral of bills, you see the definition sections 4.1, and that's where we get in and change this rule. And very simply, Mr. President, what we've done, it clarifies whatever the terms budget bill, mayor budget bill, or general appropriations bill or bills are used in the Senate rules. Those terms refer to the general appropriations bill. The amendment also clarifies that major expenses of state government could be included in bills in addition to the general appropriations bill. And we've talked about that. There are the other four bills that are moving through the process. The amendment provides that during the time the legislature is housed or meets in the joint Jonah Business Center, when the term state capital or CAPE are used in the Senate rules, those terms shall be understood to mean the Jonah Business Center. I'll be glad to answer any questions. Other than that, I ask for your favorable consideration.
Any questions with respect to the motion to adopt Senate Rule Number 1? If not, you've heard the explanation. The many of the rules requires a two-thirds vote. The chief clerk will call the roll.
Anderson?
Aye.
Aye. Barnard?
Aye.
Aye. Bebout?
Aye.
Aye. Boner?
Aye.
Aye. Burns?
Aye.
Case?
Aye.
Christensen?
Aye.
Coe?
Aye.
Cooper?
Aye.
Kraft?
Aye.
Dockstetter?
Aye.
Driscoll?
Aye.
Emmerich?
Aye.
Escobel?
Aye.
Geis?
Aye.
Hastert?
Aye.
Hicks?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Kinski? Landon?
Aye.
Meyer? Pappas?
Aye.
Aye. Perkins?
Aye.
Aye. Peterson?
Aye.
Aye. Roth?
Aye.
Rothfuss?
Aye.
Aye. Scott?
Aye.
Aye. Von Fladern?
Aye.
Aye. Wasserberger?
Aye.
Aye. President Nicholas?
Aye.
Aye. Kinski?
Well, we're missing Kinski and yes. Senators Meyer?
Yes.
Both from the floor? Are they sitting out there? I mean, can you see them out there? Or are they off? These are the rules. All right. Okay, they're both excused then.
Kinski excused, Meyer excused. Closing vote. Closing vote closed. 28 aye, 2 no. I'm sorry, two excused, zero no.
By your vote, amendment, Senate rules number one has been adopted. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, do you have the next amendment?
President, it's Senate Rule 2, and would please read in the Senate rule.
Senate Rule 2, the rules of the Senate by creating Rule 1-4, is amended to read.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move Senate Rule 2, yield to the Minority Floor Leader.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, Senate Rule 2 relates to temporary legislative facilities. This is the language that accounts for the fact we moved into the Jonah Business Building and redefines such that during the period when the legislature is housed or holds legislative sessions in the Jonah Business Center in Cheyenne, the words state capital or capital, when used in these rules, shall be understood to mean the Jonah Business Center. Obviously, a lot of the rest of the rules include reference to the capital. This accounts for those rules such that they would apply here in the Jonah Business Center.
You've heard the discussion. Are there any questions? There being none, the chief clerk will please call the roll with respect to Senate Rule number 2.
Anderson?
Aye.
Aye. Barnard?
Aye.
Aye. Bebout?
Aye.
Aye. Boner?
Aye.
Aye. Burns?
Aye.
Aye. Case?
No.
No. Christensen?
Aye.
Aye. Coe?
Aye.
Cooper?
Aye.
Aye. Kraft?
Aye.
Aye. Dockstetter?
Aye.
Aye. Driscoll?
Aye.
Aye. Emmerich?
Aye.
Aye. Esquivel?
Aye.
Geis?
Aye.
Aye. Hastert?
Aye.
Aye. Hicks?
Aye.
Aye. Johnson?
Aye.
Aye. Kinski?
Aye.
Aye. Landon?
Aye.
Aye. Meyer?
Aye.
Aye. Pappas?
Aye.
Aye. Perkins?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Ross?
Aye.
Aye. Rothfuss?
Aye.
Aye. Scott?
Aye.
Von Fladern?
Aye.
Aye. Wasserberger?
Aye.
Aye. President Nicholas?
Aye.
Aye. Closing vote? Closing vote closed. 29 aye, 1 no.
By your vote, amendment to the Senate rules, SR2. Have been adopted. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, do you have another amendment?
Thank you, Mr. President. Would you, the reading clerk please read in Joint Rule 1?
Joint Rule 1 by creating Joint Rule 1 by creating Rule 1-2 and Joint Rule 14-1 A and K are amended to read.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move Joint Rule 1 and yield to Senator Kraft.
Senator Kraft.
Thank you so much, Mr. President. What this does is clarify that whenever we use the term budget bill or mirror budget bill or general appropriations bill or bills, that whenever those are used in the joint rules, those terms are going to be referring to the general appropriations bill. And the other thing the amendment does is it clarifies that the general appropriations bill may not include the entire state budget. Some appropriations, which could be considered generally within the state budget, might be introduced in other bills, which has always been our practice in the legislature. The amendment also strikes the term budget bill and replaces that term with general appropriations bill in Joint Rule 14. And additionally, it clarifies that the general appropriations bill will proceed through that mirror bill process in exactly the same manner during both the general session and the budget session of the legislature. That's joint rule number one, and I'd ask for your favorable consideration.
Are there any further discussions, questions? Senator Meyer.
Just a comment, Mr. President. I'm getting a little heartburn about the way we're moving these different bills and having the multiple bills. I understand the genesis of it, but I think it's going to cause us some problems down because in the future, maybe not this session, but if we move forward with it, I think we're going to get back into the same problems where they decided to go with mirror bills on everything, you know, on one big budget bill. And I understand we can't legislate within the budget, But I think that, you know, I think we can control that. And I think a lot of these who are bills are really truly appropriations bills could be in the main bill. And I know this, you know, train has left the station, but, you know, I think we need to keep a real close look on it. And you guys are the master, at least you are the master, Mr. President, of figuring out how these things work. But I just hope we keep a real close look on it. It's a change from the way we've done business in the past, kind of reverting back to the past that didn't work, and that's why they went to the mirror process. So with that, I say if we keep a close look on it, but I think that we're going to have some bumps in the road. We just need to figure out how we get around them or make sure we got good shocks.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. President. And, Mr. President, those are good comments. And our colleague from Goshen County makes a lot of sense with them. Having lived during the time where we had like 8 individual budget bills before we did the mirror bill, and I know Senator Scott and Senator Geist were here as well, what happened, members of the Senate, is if you were the last one or two bills when there was no money, and there was no money a lot of the time back then, those bills and those appropriations and agencies in that bill suffered, and that's where the cuts were made. That's one of the main reasons we went to the mirrored bill. And I will tell you that Management Council has heard some consternation relative to the way we do it with one mirrored bill because there's so much in it and the inability of certain people, particularly in the houses where it came from, to be able to comprehend that. So what we did and what we tried to do is move a little further along to have the general appropriations bill with most of government, as we know it, tied to that revenue stream, be the general appropriations bill and do the 4 individual bills. Senator Meyer, one of the things that we did talk about is this is going to need some further refinement. This is a new step. We haven't done it before. Like you said, the train has left the station. It's too late to change it now, but I would hope the body would support this rule. It's where we are now, and let's give a lot of thought and consideration to how we do it the next budget cycle. Is this a way to do it? Do we go back to where we were, or is there even a better way? Thank you, Mr. President.
Further discussions or questions? If there are none, the question is, been called for, and will the chief clerk please call the roll? Again, this requires a 2/3 vote.
Anderson?
Aye.
Aye. Barnard?
Aye.
Aye. Bebout?
Aye.
Aye. Boner?
Aye.
Aye. Burns?
Aye.
Aye. Case?
Aye.
Aye. Christensen?
Aye.
Coe?
Aye.
Aye. Cooper?
Aye.
Aye. Kraft?
Aye.
Aye. Dockstader?
Aye.
Driscoll?
Aye.
Aye. Emmerich?
Aye.
Aye. Escobel?
Aye.
Aye. Geis?
Aye.
Aye. Hastert?
Aye.
Aye. Hicks?
Aye.
Aye. Johnson?
Aye.
Aye. Kinski?
Aye.
Aye. Landon?
Aye.
Aye. Meyer?
Aye.
Pappas?
Aye.
Aye. Perkins?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Aye. Ross?
Aye.
Rothfuss.
Aye.
Aye. Scott.
Aye.
Aye. Von Platern.
Aye.
Aye. Wasserberger.
Aye.
Aye. President Nicholas.
Aye.
Aye. Closing vote. Closing vote closed. 30 aye.
By your vote, the Senate has adopted Joint Rule Number 1, the changes to the rule. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk. Senator Christensen.
Mr. President, pursuant to Senate Rule 5-5, I move that Senate File 104, Volunteer Health Care, be recalled from your Committee Number 12 rules for further consideration by the Senate.
Second.
Second.
The motion is to recall Senate File 104. What was the name of the title?
Volunteer Health Care.
Volunteer Health Care from your Rules Committee. Roll call. Who are the seconds? We need names for the second. Von Platern. You need 3 seconds. Von Platern, Anderson, Driscoll.
Anderson?
Aye.
Aye. Barnard?
Aye.
Aye. Bebout?
No.
No. Boner?
Aye.
Aye. Burns?
No.
No. Case?
Aye.
Aye. Christensen?
Aye.
Aye. Coe?
Aye.
Aye. Cooper?
Aye.
Aye. Kraft?
Aye.
Aye. Dockstader?
Aye.
Aye. Driscoll?
Aye.
Aye. Emmerich?
Aye.
Aye. Escobel?
Aye.
Aye. Geis?
Aye.
Aye. Hastert?
Aye.
Aye. Hicks?
Aye.
Aye. Johnson?
Aye.
Aye. Kinski?
Aye.
Aye. Landon?
Aye.
Aye. Meyer?
Aye.
Meyer?
Aye.
Aye. Pappas?
Aye.
Aye. Perkins?
No.
No. Peterson?
Aye.
Aye. Ross?
No.
No. Rothfuss?
Aye.
Aye. Scott?
Aye.
Aye. Von Platern?
Aye.
Aye. Wasserberger?
No.
President Nicholas?
No.
No. Closing vote? Closing. Vote closed. 24 aye, 6 no.
Mr. Majority floor leader, this clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move that the Senate resolve itself and committee the whole to discuss bills on general file.
You all heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That motion has been adopted. Senator Christensen.
Committee of the Whole will please come to order. The first bill for our consideration is Senate File 31. Will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 31, Omnibus Water Bill Planning, sponsored by the Water Committee, an act relating to water development projects. It was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, which returns a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Barnard, Christensen, Dockstader, Emmerich, and Geis. Senator Geis, Chairman.
Senator Geis, you've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Oh, excuse me. Senator Geis, there you go, your mic's on.
Better? Okay. Do I have to redo it?
If you would, sir.
I'll rise and report that I move Senate file. Like that? Okay. Move that Senate file 30 do pass, or 31. It's the omnibus water bill. You all have a cheat sheet out there on your desk somewhere. And I'm going to run down the cheat sheet. The Senate Ag Committee all have books like this. So if there's any one of the projects that you want to talk to me between now and second reading, why, we can do that. With that, I'm going to go pretty fast. The first tab is tab D in the blue book here I have. And that tells you what page it's on. And then it tells you it's a level one project, a new development. So these are all state dollars, or all money come from the water development account, no general fund, no nothing. First one is the Basin Planning Environmental and Rec Use Study. Now, this is a new item that we're taking on because there's a lot of demand wanting to know whether we could develop things for recreation and all the other things that go on. And so we're going to study each water basin and then come back and be able to tell you where we might improve some of that. The next one is tab E, page 2, Bear River Data Model Pilot Program, and that's in Lincoln and Uinta County. It's $120,000. It's a river basin study on the Bear River over on the west side of the state of Wyoming. The next one is F, page 2, Goose Creek Watershed, Johnson Sheridan County, 370,000 watershed study. The next one is Manerson, tab G, Manerson Water Master Plan, Bighorn County, 100,000 master plan. The next one is Melody Ranch over in Teton County. That is 180,000 master plan. The next one is, you know, you got your cheat sheet, so you know the tab and the page, and so I'm just going to name the projects and go right through it. Northwest Rural Water Master Plan, Bighorn Park County, 230,000 master plan. The next one is the Northwest Ridge Rural Water Master Plan, Bighorn, I read that one. Next one is Owl Creek Watershed Study, Hot Springs County, 375,000. The next one is Rock River Water Master Plan, Albany County, 150,000. The next one is Shell Master Water Plan, Bighorn County, 185,000. The next one is South Platte River Watershed, Laramie County, 395,000. The next one is South Worland Water Master Plan, Washakie County, $90,000. The next one is Statewide Water Research, and that goes to the University of Wyoming. I'll study some of these projects. That's $311,000 for account one. That total is $2,886,328. Now we're going into level two study. These are Buckskin Extension, Pipeline, Regional Pipeline, Gillette, Campbell County, 65,000. That's a subdivision out there. We got to see how it's going to cost to get the pipelines put in. The next one is the Fontanelle Dam Outwork Infrastructure, located in Lincoln, Sweetwater County, 200,000. What we have to do there is study that. We have to drop the water level clear down because Fontanelle Dam only has facing on the top third of the dam, and if we want to utilize all that water there, we've got to go on down and fix it so that when the water slices against the dam, it won't wash it away. Next one is Fox Ridge Extension, Gillette, Wyoming, Campbell County, 130,000. Next one is Glendale Reservoir Full Utilized Project, Platte County, 300,000. And what we're doing there, we're wanting to make the feds let us keep that flood water in that dam so we don't have to release it until July, August, when the irrigators are working. The next one is Graceland Extension. That's another regional place in Campbell County. 105,000. Luff Water Supply Study, Niobrara County, 175,000. Platte Alliance Water Supply Study, Goshen County, 200,000. Now that one, we're going to join up with part of Nebraska because they all have that sulfate in their water down there. So that'll be a joint feature. This is just Wyoming's share, and Scotts Bluff, Nebraska, and those are putting in the other 200,000 for that total study. And then the University of Wyoming Irrigation Water Supply, Albany County, 400,000. Subtotal of that is 175,000. So now we're going down to level one rehabs. This call comes out of account two. Cottonwood Irrigation District Master Plan, Lincoln County. That's 165,000. The next one, Eden Valley Irrigation District Master Plan, Sublette, Sweetwater County, 195,000. Next one is Hanover Irrigation District Master Plan, Washakie County, 175,000. The next one is Lovell Irrigation District Master Plan, Bighorn County, $165,000. The subtotal for that would be $700,000. And then we go down, and this comes out of account one, University Office Water Program, statewide, $175,000. We pay part of the expense for the director over there that's in the university to work these plans. So with that, we started out in, we spent $4,636,328 in that one. We spent $700,000 in a water development account two. The total money we spent in account one is $30,427,470. In account two, we spent $5,109,000 for $640. And for next year, because we split these monies, we get the total money, but we appropriate half of it each year. So for 2017, account one will have $35,063,798. Account two, which was the one that hurts the most, has $5,809,640. That's the budget bill. I'd ask for your adoption. If you have any questions, come talk to me and I'll show them to you.
Question having been called, are you ready? All those in favor of Senator Geis's motion to adopt Committee of the Whole, the Senate bill, say aye. Senate file 31, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That one passes. All right, the motion to adopt is passed. All those, we go on. Senate file 31 is passed. Committee of the Whole, the next bill for Mr. Majority Floor Leader. You've heard the motion. All in favor, say aye. Opposed? Okay. 10 minutes.
I'm not going to shut it off for 10 minutes. Randy said not to. How do you want? You want this number 8? Well, when you brought it back to me, I had found another one.
And we hope that she was unnecessarily alarmed, but she's got enough money at stake, so thank you.
You got her? Thank you.
Pretty easy for me.
Go fast.
We used our 10 minutes.
Yeah, we're going to come back in 10 minutes.
Hey, Alan, we've used our 10 minutes, haven't we?
Yes, sir.
2, 4, 6. All right, let's go ahead and get started again. The next bill for your consideration is Senate File 45. The reading clerk will read the Senate file.
Senate File 45, Rural Health Care Districts Authority, sponsored by the Labor Committee, an act relating to rural health care districts, was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, which reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Boner, Kraft, Driscoll, Peterson, and Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman.
All right. Senator Scott, you've heard the...
I move in the Committee of the Whole rise and report to do so with a recommendation that Senate File 45 do pass in the outstanding committee amendment.
Excuse me, Senator Scott. If you could make that motion again.
It was read in.
We read it in, but I didn't have the mic on for Senator Scott.
Oh, okay. Mr. Chairman, I move when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so with a recommendation that Senate File 45 do pass. There were no standing committee amendments, and I yield to Senator Kraft for an explanation of the Senate file.
Thank you. Senator Kraft.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 45 was considered during the interim by the Joint Labor Health Social Services Committee, and what it's seeking to do is to provide rural health care districts with the same authority as hospital districts. So basically what Senate File 45 does is it takes rural health care districts and inserts them into the hospital district statutes. Now, there are several rural health care districts around Wyoming, but there's one county that currently doesn't have a hospital district. They only have a rural health care district. And they would very much like to expand their clinic to be a critical access hospital. And under our current statute, that's an impossible thing for them to do. So what Senate File 45 would do, it would afford the same borrowing authority, the same authority to operate a hospital to a rural health care district as a hospital district currently has. And we heard testimony that without passage of Senate File 45, the only avenue that would be available to a rural health care district in the situation that this particular county is in, if they're wanting to try to expand and operate a hospital, they'd have to have two elections. First thing they'd have to do would be have an election to disband the rural health care district. Then they'd have to have another election, assuming the first election successful. They'd have to have another one to create a hospital district. So that's it. That's a kind of a cumbersome, uncertain process, and we heard a lot of concern about the gap that might be in between those two. So rather, what we would like to do is just make this availability to the rural health care districts. And we heard a great deal of testimony about the importance of having these critical access hospitals in these small rural communities. We heard particularly about their ability as a critical access, as opposed to just being a clinic, better able to care for accident victims and for stroke, heart attack victims. If you remember last year, We talked a great deal about having a network availability between hospitals and EMTs so they could communicate with each other. We passed that legislation so that patients' records were communicated quickly, and we found that one of the areas that that's really critical for is stroke. Stroke patients, there's two kinds of strokes, and if you administer medication for the wrong one, that can be fatal to a patient. So that was just one of the examples we heard of that really speaks to the importance of this for these rural communities. They're eligible for a lot more grant support. They could get the higher rate for Medicaid, Medicare. They could be part of this network that we created over the last couple of years. They've done a feasibility study, and they're pretty sure that this is the only way healthcare services will survive in this particular county is if they are successful in being able to create a hospital under a rural healthcare district. That's Senate File 45 in a nutshell. I would stand for questions, and I would ask for your favorable consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Kraft. We do have an amendment. If you'd like to deal with that, the reading clerk could read in the amendment.
Senate File 45, Committee of the Whole, Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 7.
Thank you. Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman,
I would move first reading Amendment Number 1 to Committee of the Whole, Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 45. Members of the body, what I hope to do with this is provide a little more certainty for the funding and the operation of these rural health care districts. So if we go into the elections provisions on 32.2708 on page 17, under the current scenario is this mill levy would go up every 4 years automatically. Well, let me tell you what that does is every 4 years it's on the ballot. So what happens is it creates a great deal of uncertainty for the employees. So the reality is every 3 years, your employees start submitting for jobs everywhere else because they don't, quite frankly, there's no certainty that they're going to have a job. The other thing it creates an immense problem for is if you're applying for federal grant or aid or some other program to try to contract and administer those monies past the last date. So in effect, it reduces the ability to seek health care from standpoint of utilizing other funds to contract beyond the point of whatever your mill levy is. What this does is just change it. It says it can go back onto the ballot. It sets a very low bar that says only 10% of the electorates would be required to sign a petition, take that to the county commissioners, it's back on the ballot. It's a very low bar. Here's the other thing that this, if we leave it the way it is right now, automatically the county clerk's got to put that on the ballot every 4 years. And a lot of times, my experience has been with those, if you have a very successful district and the people are happy, it's just a waste and time and effort of your county clerk to put that on the ballot, tally up the ballots, and get that information out there. So I'd ask for your favorable consideration of this amendment. I'd stand for any questions.
Discussion on the amendment. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, on and for the amendment. Mr. Chairman, and I'm presuming that the amendment is properly drawn in the right place, and I think it only affects these rural health care districts, and testimony was five of them, but there's only one that is likely to consider having a hospital district, and that is in Sublette County. Mr. Chairman, it is very important that you have the initial election to make sure there is the community support that is needed to make this thing work. But after that, you've got a hospital running. It's even worse than the good senator from Carbon County explained if you have uncertainty, because you're dealing with an ongoing operation that would be very expensive and difficult to close down, do without, and you don't want to see it abolished or crippled. So I think that the amendment will strengthen the bill in this particular respect, and I urge the Senate to adopt it.
Further discussion on the amendment. Senator Kraft.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. I would echo the words of the good chairman and urge your adoption of this amendment also. The county clerk at the county that is in question with this particular piece of legislation was present at our committee meeting this morning and discussed how it would all work. And the points made by the bringer of the amendment are certainly accurate, that after that first election, we hope they'll be able to focus on running their hospital. So I, too, would urge your support of the amendment.
Thank you. Further discussion on the amendment? Question having been called. All those in favor of Senator Hicks's motion to adopt Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 45, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion to adopt the Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 45 has passed. We are back on the bill. Question having been called. All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion, when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 45, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 45 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 61.
Senate File 61, Occupational Health and Safety Act, Civil Penalties, sponsored by the Labor Committee, was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, which returns a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Boner, Kraft, Driscoll, Peterson, and Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Scott?
Mr. Chairman, I move when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 61 do pass. There were no standing committee amendments, and I will explain the bill. Mr. President, this is a bill to get us in compliance with something the federal government did. And this has been a fairly routine sort of thing in particularly the workforce services areas. I suspect, and I haven't added it up, but I suspect that 30 out of my 38 years down here, we've had one of these bills of this general nature. The feds do something. It's an area where they're putting up most of the money. It's an area we need to comply in, and we don't have much choice in the matter. This bill, Mr. Chairman, is very much in that description. But in a sense, we do potentially have a choice. If we turn the bill down, we will do away with the state operation of the federal OSHA program, and we'll have the feds in operating the OSHA program with all that implies. And about there's 20-some of the states that have done it that way. The testimony we had in committee was that that's not a good idea. We heard, and I confess that I solicited fairly publicly input from the interested parties, and we heard from a number of the business organizations. We heard from an advocacy group that's a consumer advocacy group in this area. We heard from organized labor, and they were unanimous in saying, okay, maybe we don't like what the feds have done to us with these fines, but we had better comply because the current system with the state program is working very well. And actually, the gentleman representing labor gave very cogent and very extensive testimony as to exactly how well it was working and why it was working so well, and the business groups that agreed with him. So, Mr. Chairman, there's unanimous support from the interested parties out there. The new director of the Workforce Services Department has been quite creative. He's discovered that there's an overmatch with the federal match, and these aren't general funds. These are workers' comp funds. So he's moving the excess money the state is now spending, excess personnel that are above the match, into the workers' comp division, where they won't be subject to all the onerous federal record-keeping requirements And I think that will significantly improve the safety effort in this state. So I think we're getting the best of two worlds, and I would strongly urge the Senate, Mr. Chairman, to pass this bill. I would say we have had the fines in statute. The system the Fed set up, they're going to adjust it every year or two for inflation. There will be a major increase because it's been a while since they had an increase this time, and then there'll be a series of smaller ones as time goes on. So we can't go back to the old system of putting the specific fines in the statutes. We're basically giving the department free rein to comply with the federal requirements, and I think that's the right thing to do in this particular case, Mr. Chairman. Even though as a general proposition, I don't like doing it that way. But it's necessary here, and we are making progress in the safety issues. We had quite a bit of testimony on that, and it's working, folks. Let's keep it working.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the Labor Committee's hard work on this particular issue. It's a big one to the state and very important issue. The one thing I would say that although we don't appreciate necessarily what the feds have done, since the system is now working rather than upside that apple cart, it's better to do it. The question I have is, at some point in time, if they become so onerous that we really can't deal with it and we have this in our statutes, then we will have to go back in and change our statutes so we're really committed, and that's something we'll have to do in the future.
Chairman Scott.
Senator yes.
Scott.
Mr. Chairman, that's accurate. There's two ways to do it. More than one way to skin the cat around here. If the feds get unreasonable and we'd be better off with strictly a state program, we could introduce a bill and get 16 senators and 31 House members to vote for it and the governor to agree that would put us out of the federal program. Or we could go into the budget, and this is workers' comp funds, but I believe that comes through the budget every year, and we could remove the appropriation that allows them to match the federal funds, and that would have the same effect. So there's more than one way to skin the cat if the cat needs skinned.
Thank you. Further discussion? Further discussion. Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion, that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 61, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 61 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 32.
Senate File 32, Alternative School Accountability, an act relating to the Wyoming Education and Accountability Act, sponsored by the Education Committee. It was referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Burns, Hastert, Perkins, Ross, and Wasserberger. Senator Ross, Chairman.
Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, move when Committee of the Whole rise report do so with do pass recommendation on...
Excuse me, Senator Coe. Got a mic you up. Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, move when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so with a do pass recommendation on Senate File 32. Senate File 32 is the Alternative School Accountability Bill. There is a standing committee amendment. I ask that be read in at this time.
The reading clerk will please read the amendment.
Senate File 32, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 10, line 14.
Yes. Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 32 and ask the body's favorable consideration. What this did was we came in and made a number of deductions that were represented and advised to us by the committee, the standing committee that the sponsor of the bill. So we took their suggestions, incorporated those, and just reduced those amounts to amounts that the committee itself, not the Appropriations Committee, but the sponsoring committee determined were appropriate and asked us to do. So That's what that does. It reduces a couple of those expenditures a little bit. Five, you know, you can see what they are. It just reduces it a few dollars here and a few dollars there in accordance with what their recommendation was to us. Thank you.
Thank you. Discussion on the Standing Committee Amendment. Question having been called, all those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to Senate File 32, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. All right. The motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to Senate File 32 has passed. We are back on the bill. Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, this is the Alternative School Accountability Bill. Remember that we passed the Wyoming Accountability and Education Act in 2011, and we had a moratorium on alternative schools. We took that off in 2014. What this bill does is it realizes that alternative schools are different animals. We have to have flexibility in how we hold them accountable under the Wyoming Accountability and Education Act. So what it does, it continues the work related to alternative school accountability required under the Act, and it also continues to exempt alternative schools from the school level accountability ratings because they have to be different, and that's in phase one of accountability. It refines the indicators proposed by the Technical Advisory Committee that studied the issue over the 2015 interim. It also tasked the Department of Education with undertaking building a specific model for alternative schools and piloting that model over the 2016-17 school year. Also, we'll require the department to propose business rules to govern the operation of the model. Probably one of the key things it does, the other really key thing it does, it continues the operation of the Select Committee on Education Accountability and the Technical Advisory Committee through December 31st of 2018, and that's why you see a $70,000 appropriation in there for that Select Committee, because it's over 2 years, $35,000 a year. As you go through the bill, if you want to look at different things, Section 1 talks about the pilot project, all the different parameters on that for the Alternative School Accountability Act. Page 3, for instance, lines 1 through 22 are indicators for graduation. Everything has to be treated different with alternative schools. There's a system of support that's built into it, reach different levels through the task force. Section 2 is the enhances the Alternative School Technical Advisory Group to be involved in how we come up with the model that we're going to have for alternative schools. Section 3 is where we sustain and keep in operation the Select Committee on Accountability, as I said, through 12/31/18. It also, there's a paragraph in there that says, like we did this last year, the Select Committee will meet jointly with the Joint Education Committee like we did in December. And Section 4 has the appropriations in it. With the amendment, there's $10,000 in it for support for State Board of Education and Department of Education, and there's $70,000 in it to for the Select Committee on Accountability. Members of the Senate, that's the bill. I try to answer any questions.
Discussion on the bill.
Question.
Question having been called, all those in favor of Senator Coe's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 32, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 32 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 46. The reading clerk, please read the bill.
Senate File 46, Asset Forfeiture 1, an act relating to the Wyoming Controlled Substances Act, sponsored by the Judiciary Committee. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Christensen, Esquivel, Hicks, Kinski, and Von Flatern, Senator Christensen, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Hicks, Mr. Vice Chair?
I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 3.
It's on.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 3, and I would refer to Senator Esquivel for an explanation of the bill.
On Senate File 46?
Oh, excuse me. Mr. Chairman, let me rephrase that. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 46, and I would defer to Senator Kinski for an explanation of the bill.
Senator Kinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The subject matter of Senate File 46 was the subject of an interim study prior to the last general session, which resulted in a bill that was passed by both chambers, vetoed by the governor. Subsequently, your Judiciary Committee worked closely with the Attorney General's office to fashion a bill that was acceptable to all. It's a model of collaboration and cooperation that brings this bill before you today. The subject matter of this is the seizure and forfeiture of the property of citizens. And the subject matter typically comes up in the context of drug dealers. But that's not our primary concern, because this bill provides for summary, the current law, which provides for summary destruction of drugs, is preserved. The current law, which provides for summary destruction of the laboratories and the instruments to manufacture the drugs, is preserved. Rather, the focus of this bill is on those items of a citizen's property that are not used in the manufacture of those sorts of things, typically cars, cash, homes, guns. And we're not concerned, again, about the drug dealers, but about the innocent who may be caught up in the snares wrongfully, unintentionally, of law enforcement. And we're concerned about protecting the Constitution, which, after all, says the property may not be taken without due process of law. The bill provides for four distinct procedures. First would be the precedure procedure. Typically roadside. There's a policeman that's got somebody stopped, or if they're at a house, they'll found something. They want to know whether they can seize it or not. If they do, we then proceed to a preliminary hearing determination of probable cause by a judge or magistrate. If he determines there's probable cause, it goes to trial. And if the trial finds that the item should, in fact, be forfeited, they are forfeited, and we have provisions for post-trial disposal of the property. If you'd go with me, please, to the bottom of page 2 and the top of page 3, you'll see we've added a governmental immunity clause for those of the government involved in these seizures to insulate them against suit for their acts. On page 3, we have a series of definitions leading over to the top of page 4, and you'll notice that none of these are drugs. It's things like buildings, vehicles, aircraft, vessels, and so forth. Now on page 4, beginning at page 13, we outline the procedure as to what is to happen when an officer has property. He calls the Attorney General's office, he outlines the circumstances, then the Attorney General either authorizes the officer to seize the property and give notice to that person as to when their hearing will be regarding the property, or to release the property. Going over to page 6, starting at line 10, if the property is seized, this outlines the procedure for a probable cause hearing on a timely manner to determine whether the property should be bound over for a forfeiture hearing. Page 7, if there is probable cause found, the commissioner may file an action. And the balance of this is the timeline and the procedures for filing the complaint and going to trial. That's outlined on pages 7, 8, 9 is the trial procedure, which also says that they are to make due diligence to identify any third parties who may have an interest in the property, and give them notice of the proceeding. On page 10 outlines the elements of the complaint. Page 11 at the top provides that the forfeiture can only be upon clear and convincing evidence, which is less than beyond a reasonable doubt, but more than the preponderance of the evidence standard. The next section, 6 to 13, is the protections for a innocent owner. And if they can show that they're innocent, they need only to prove that by a preponderance of the evidence, at which time they're able to redeem their interest in the property. Pages 11 through 12 define a innocent purchaser or innocent owner, And then lines 11 to 12 specify that there is a right to trial by jury. Page 13 is something that's critical. It says that any forfeiture must be proportional to the crime. That comes from a U.S. Supreme Court hearing, that the forfeiture cannot be so disproportionate to the crime as to be unjust. Page 14, if there's anything that received a lot of discussion, it's on page 14, lines 5 to 12, which provides that if property was wrongfully forfeited, the prevailing property owner is entitled to attorney's fees and costs and damages. That was the single most controversial portion of our bill, and I think that's the one that we were most divided about. Subsequent to that, lines 13, pages 14, 15, 16, 17 are how the property is to be disposed of. Page 19 allows the government to use the property for its own purposes after forfeiture. And then 19 to 20 outlines that there shall be an annual report to this body regarding the number of forfeitures, the nature, the costs, and so forth. With that, I'll stand for questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Kinski. Discussion on the bill.
Question.
Question having been called. All those in favor of Senator Hicks's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 46. Say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Senate File 46 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 3. The reading clerk would read the Senate file.
Senate File 3, Permissive Preference for Veterans in Private Employment, an Act Relating to Veterans, sponsored by the Transportation Committee. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Christensen, Esquivel, Hicks, Kinski, and Von Flatern. Senator Christensen, Chairman.
Senator Hicks. You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the committee of the whole rises and reports it. Whoop.
There you go, sir. Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the committee of the whole rises and reports that it do so with a recommendation on Senate File 3 of a due pass. I will refer to Senator Esquivel for an explanation of the bill.
Senator Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bring to you Senate File number 3 of Permissive Preference for Veterans in Private Employment. My life is my...
You're on now.
Okay. And this this bill, to my knowledge, has been studied by two different committees, and it's come out the same way on both, overwhelmingly in favor of it. And this bill basically allows a private employer. We all... public employers can already give a preference to veterans in employment, but this gives private employers that right to give a preference to veterans and spouses of disabled and deceased veterans. You know, so in the state, it's not it's permissive. The private employer may grant the preference. So in a situation where a private employer has two applicants equally qualified, the employer can give that preference to the one that is a veteran without having to fear some type of discrimination complaint, especially if the other applicant is a female. On the other hand, an employer, I guess, you know, because it's his permissive, an employer could just flip a coin to decide which applicant he wants to hire. But the main reason for this bill is because it's to protect the private employer from any charges of sexual discrimination, for example, because there are more male veterans than female veterans. So this is one way of providing that protection to private employers. And as I stated previously, it is a permissive preference. It's not mandatory, and you all should have a couple of handouts that were distributed to you that go much more in detail. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll take whatever questions might come up.
Thank you, Senator Escobel. Discussion. Question having been called, all those in favor of Senator Hicks's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 3, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Senate File 3 is passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 2. The reading clerk would read the Senate file.
Senate File 2, Attorney General Opinions Legislative Request, an act relating to administration and government, sponsored by the Management Council. It was referred to Committee Number 12, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Bebout, Kraft, Nicholas, Perkins, and Rothfuss. Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the committee whole rise and report it, do so with a favorable consideration set for Senate File 2. Ladies and gentlemen, what this addresses is the issue about when and how attorney general's opinions are to be solicited. If you turn over to page 2 of the bill, you'll see the existing state language. The existing state statute language provides that when requested, the Attorney General shall provide opinions with respect to elected and appointed state officers. And then the existing language on line 9, page 2, says to either branch of the legislature when in session. That was the existing language. We have issues this summer where an individual's legislators asked for opinions of the Attorney General individually outside of session that asked about the constitutionality of a bill. The Attorney General declined to give the opinion on the basis that it was a conflict of interest because under law, when the legislature adopts a statute, the Attorney General is then obliged to represent the Chief Executive Officer to support and defend all bills that we pass. So the Attorney General issued an opinion, and we actually toned it down a little bit, said we will come back and take a look at the issue. And what we're doing in this bill is really reflecting what is a more appropriate guidance with respect to when the Attorney General serves as the Chief Executive Officer or the Chief Counsel to the Governor, which is the Chief Executive Officer, and when and how the legislature can ask for opinions from the Attorney General. So what we've done is, beginning of line 4, page 2, is say that the request by any legislator or legislative body shall be submitted in accordance with subsection B. Down below B, what we say is that the either branch of that legislature, when in session, in accordance with the rules of each house. So this would be the branch. So it's not an individual legislator, rather that it is the branch of the legislature that can ask for these opinions. And then certainly a management council of the legislature. So the legislature is considered as a body, and the Attorney General is called upon to represent the legislature, not legislators. Now, it's a different issue if you're sued. There's other statutes that come in and say legislators are defended by the Attorney General. We did want to make provision, though, to make sure that individual legislators could seek advice when there's issues of personal conflict of interest, and you see that at lines 15 through 19, the provision for if you have an issue about personal conflict of interest, you can have direct access as an individual legislator to the Attorney General for opinions. There will be ongoing efforts to over the course of the next year for the LSO to begin to analyze better and more deeply with respect to who does the LSO represent. Do they represent us individually so that if you go in and you give them a bill or you ask a question, is that an individual attorney-client privilege, or is it does the privilege belong to the entire body? Now, we can modify and make changes with respect to confidentiality, which we have, where attorneys, when they take your product and you you meet with them individually. It's not released to other members until you authorize it. But it becomes a bit more complication, or it becomes more complicated when we begin to look at whether or not you actually have an attorney-client relationship with the attorneys that are in the legislature. It's a very complicated topic. I think that explains the question or the bill, and I would stand for questions and discussion.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I think I understand why the Attorney General would be reticent about giving an opinion on the constitutionality of a proposed bill. He could get himself in a real box in that circumstance. But let me pose a different scenario. Suppose some constituent comes to one of us and says, you know, Agency X is not implementing the bill that you guys passed last time the way they should. They're implementing it exactly opposite of how they were supposed to. And you look at it and you think, yeah, they probably got something there. And you want to get an attorney general's opinion as to what that law really says and what it means. How do we proceed in those circumstances? Because I can certainly, the way the executive branch behaves sometimes, I can certainly see that happening. We need to be able to take some steps to provide a remedy for our constituents. And the remedy doesn't necessarily mean a new law, because if they aren't obeying the existing one, what do we do?
Yes.
Chairman, that's a great question, and I can actually make that question even more complicated, because when you take the question that you just described, and if an agency is not acting in accordance with what you believe to be the law, remember, the Attorney General under the Constitution and state statute is the chief legal counsel for the agencies. So that means that there are assistant attorney generals actually providing advice to the agencies. So if you were to go to the Bar Association, for example, and say, can you as a member, as an executive agency representing an executive agency client, provide an opinion that your client is violating the law? But where I said you can actually make it even more intriguing is say, well, what about if the county attorney or the Board of County Commissioners or some other board or some other agency, that they're not following law and you want an interpretation of the statute? With respect to that, there is no such attorney-client privilege. So we know that in time, I think there are about 80 opinions that have existed in time that were either informal attorney general opinions or formal opinions that were actually prepared by the attorney general or his staff as a courtesy to the legislature. The attorney general has come back and concluded that his client is the chief executive officer, and you can have under law, existing law, elective and appointed state officers can ask for opinions. But remember, existing law provides that either branch of the legislature can ask for it. So in a sense, what the attorney general did is come back and said, I read that to say that only the legislature in session can ask for these opinions. What my predecessors have done in the past, they've done it as a matter of convenience. And we've clarified that, but now the intersection between rules of professional conduct and remembering that the attorney general is an officer of the court, which means that he has legal obligations that are formed and based through the judiciary department. He has statutory duties and constitutional duties, and he has these statutory areas, and we have a conflict for. And this is all this bill does is address the issue of explaining what it means when it says by either branch of session our legislature when in session, so we make it clear that they have to be by rules in the House. Outside of session, it would be management council. So in your question, I think you would have to, under this rule, approach management council and ask the management council to issue the request. Management council could do it, but individual legislators could not.
Further discussion?
Question.
Senator Cooper.
Yeah, just a very, very quick question to the sponsor. I understand what you were saying on taking it to the management council. So they would have like a vote on it or something? Is that the way it would happen if you took an issue to it and you say you'd like to have an attorney general's opinion on this? And what would be the procedure, I guess, by the council, I guess?
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, that is exactly how it would happen. That is, if you had a concern of the magnitude that our colleague from Casper talked about, where you believe that there was an issue, management council would take up the issue and present it to as a formal request for an opinion from the council on behalf of the legislature. That doesn't mean that you're going to necessarily get an opinion, because if the AG decides he has a conflict of interest under the rules of conduct that are part of the essentially spawned out of, if you will, the rules of conduct in the judiciary, because you're a member of the bar, they might abstain from that opinion. In most, if it's a county, if there's no conflict of interest, it's an easy question. If it's a question, as our colleague asked, what about a state agency, I didn't want to say it's an easy question. You go to management council, they request the opinion, and you're entitled to an opinion back, because that may create a conflict of interest. Now, the Attorney General does have access to hire special assistant attorney generals who are not employees of the department and bring them in to provide, so that he has resources and capacities to avoid those conflicts of interest, but those are discretionary.
Yes, Senator Bebelt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. One other thing that you would also do, and I think in the procedure, you would go to the LSO who helped you with the bill, and then you would ask them to render their opinion, quite frankly, and that's what you take to management council to support your concerns.
Further discussion? Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, for the question for the sponsor in his articulating what this was for, he used the terminology formal opinion and informal opinion, but I don't find that language in the bill. So just a clarification on that would be one, Mr. Chairman. Then I was wondering if it would be possible to get copies of the memo from the AG's office, and maybe that was sent out, and I just missed that on this issue, if that was possible.
Thank you, Senator Hicks. Yes, Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, as far as I know, the letter is public record. I will make sure it is. If it is, we will have it distributed. I don't know why it wouldn't be, but let me make that inquiry. I don't think it was... I think it's public record, because I think it was brought up at a management council, but my assumption is it was not an executive session. But I'll make that inquiry. If it is, we'll get it distributed to you. Second kick question is what's the difference between a formal and informal opinion? And having been an attorney general in my lifetime, I just happen to know those issues. But when a request for legal advice is presented to the Attorney General, they have a process for both formal and informal opinions. And the scrutiny provided to the with respect to those opinions is different. An informal opinion is one that might see the eyes of the Assistant Attorney General as assigned to an agency and maybe a deputy, and may or may not be signed by the AG himself. A formal opinion would ordinarily bear at least three signatures, that of the attorney principally in charge, the deputy, as well as of the division that the attorney is, as well as the attorney general. If it's an informal decision, they are not publicly published. So they, the only way to know whether those opinions exist is that the client, or they're typically clients, it's typically agencies, they'll know what the opinion is because it's in their file, and they might forget about it. The Attorney General can find them through their internal databases. But there were times where those, they now that's all electronic, you can find it. There are times where you couldn't even find it. You might have to go find out who that AG opinion was given to. The formal opinions are published. It used to be they were published in a three or a binded notebook, and you there are in our offices, somewhere in our libraries, you can find a series of all AG opinions that are formal. Now, if you're on Westlaw, you can call them up on Westlaw.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, just one quick question. So would this bill cover both formal and informal opinions or requests for opinions? That's the clarification I'm trying to get.
Oh, thank you. And
Mr.
I apologize.
President.
The majority floor leader is asking the same question. That's a decision that's outside of anybody's control. That's an internal AG issue. So the AG, the Attorney General and his staff would determine, based upon the question that's presented, whether it deserves a formal or an informal. Ordinarily, if it's a simple question, and particularly if it really involves a very specific issue that's not likely to be of any use to anybody else, those will be informal opinions. And you can kick out an informal opinion, you know, in a month or so. If it's a formal opinion that's going to have broader application and it really goes to the constitutionality of a statute or things like that, those opinions take months to develop. And but that is a decision that's internal to the AG office. Outside clients, the legislature would not determine that. That's just like if you're in the federal bench, there are some decisions are published, some are not. And how they're published, and the judge themselves decides which ones to publish. All the appellate decisions are published in the world, but lower case decisions really aren't published. They're hard to find.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, and I'm not trying to be argumentative here, but I'm just trying to figure out, would this prevent an individual legislature from asking for an informal opinion? Or would you have to, if you were going to do an informal opinion, do you still have to go through management council, be in session? That's what I'm just trying to
say. Oh, okay. Well,
does this cover both informal and formal opinions?
Yes, and I'd apologize to the President and the Majority Floor Leader. I haven't been using your proper titles. President Nicholas.
Thank you. The answer is it applies to both.
Senator Meyer.
Chairman. Mr. Chairman, couple of questions. I guess let's start with, there is a reference to the Constitution and duties and powers of the Attorney General. I couldn't find Attorney General in the index of the Constitution, and I'm just trying to find out what article and section that was to start with. So if we could have that information. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Meyer. Senator Case.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I don't know exactly what I think. I have.
It's on. Oh, wrong. Didn't click. Senator Case, there you are.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm kind of mulling this over, and don't know exactly what I think. I know that in the past I have been able to get Attorney General opinions, but I've been around a long time and things have changed. It does seem, you know, there's part of an effort as we organize the legislature. It's certainly not the legislature that would have existed at the times when some of the esteemed senators that predate me here was, you know. And that the fact that it has moved towards a legislature where everything kind of moves through a management council of leadership and elected representatives is something that's not really anticipated in our Constitution. It's a different thing. It has a funny feeling, and I don't mean this disingenuously, but it feels like all the animals are equal, except for some of the animals are more equal than others. And that just that a lot happens here now through management council that are purviews of this legislature and each house. And it can be that we now have bills that come out of Management Council that are the purview of standing committees. We have Management Council now approving whether a legislator can have an opinion or not rendered. It has to meet some standard or some be of some, you know. So I am representing that I'm uncomfortable with the way this has been going. And I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Senator Case. Further discussion on the bill? Thank you. Mr. President, you had a question or two posed to you.
I'll get back to you with respect to the Constitution, but doing my search here as we're doing it, I think you're going to find that the Attorney General is a statutory creation. And it's not a constitutional creation, but we'll find out here in just a second. With respect to the practice, and I think my colleague from Fremont County makes a good point, that the practice in the past has been that we have exercised broad invitation or by grace access to the Attorney General's office. And that grace that's been provided has been developed over history, and it has developed in areas where there were no tension between the electeds, that the questions that were being asked of were not confrontational, and the Attorney General exercised his grace in order to provide advice. The number of requests is changing. I can tell you, as an Attorney General, you might get from a legislator when I was serving in the 80s, you get one or two requests a year. What is happening now, among other things, is that legislators over time have developed a notion that they have a right of access to the Attorney General's that belongs to them, that once they're elected somehow, the Attorney General is now their chief legal counsel, and they can access the chief legal counsel as though that was their legal counsel. Under statute, we hired the chief legal counsel for the state, and he is hired by and is counsel to the governor. That's the way the statutes provide. And now we have, but if you'd gone back in the 80s, there was little to no legal staff in the attorney or in the LSO. The first attorney that ever staffed it was a gentleman named Ralph Thomas, who was my father's former law partner from Lander, and that was about 1969 to 1970. That was the first time this body ever had its own counsel. And now we're up to a dozen attorneys representing us. The world has changed. The number of requests have changed. And the Attorney General is prepared to say, look, you are not my client. Your individual members are not my client. And your individual members are not entitled to drive my staff. I'm going to have my staff do what they're required to do. And we have to attend to those concerns. But we do want to have access to the Attorney General on terms that work for everybody. This rule was really a compromise that was worked out with the Attorney General that reflects issues. It does not waive his right to assert that he has a conflict of interest. As our access to the executive branch counsel and the counsel for the state of Wyoming, who represents the legislature in some events, is restricted to members, then we're now taking a look at more carefully when does LSO staff, what are their limitations? And we will be exploring that over the next year.
Senator Case.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's an interesting thing for me because I have approached LSO staff for opinions as a consequence of the Attorney General deciding that individual legislators can't have opinions. And I've only done this informally.
don't misinterpret what I'm saying. I haven't asked LSO for a formal opinion. But frankly, working through the LSO, they're not willing to go out on a limb for an individual legislator against policies that may be the purview of leadership, for example. I don't see where individual legislators go. And we're duly elected. We stand here. We represent people. We have needs for counsel. And I don't feel right now that if we can't go to the LSO or to the Attorney General, that we can necessarily go to the LSO. Because I think they pretty much work for management counsel. And as they certainly feel that way when you talk to them informally. So help me out here. How is this all going to work out?
Thank you, Senator Case. President Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, I think those are great questions. And if I knew exactly how it would turn out over time, I'd love to tell you. I think that the this is an area that our past practices have been developed out of grace. When I started practicing law, it was not uncommon for attorneys to represent husbands and wives in divorces. We could say, well, it doesn't look to me like you got a big issue. I can represent both of you. Very common practice. Today, you wouldn't even consider doing that because the bar has realized over time, it evolved and said those are simply conflicts that can't exist. You can represent one but not the other party. And so the I can think of a number of practices that were common representing corporations and shareholders or different members of shareholders. It was pretty common practice in the 80s, but certainly way back when there was only one lawyer in town. The world has changed, and the standards for lawyers has increased immensely. And the rules of conflict of interest, it used to be you'd call your colleagues, talk to them. Now the decisions are a mile high. We see lawyers getting sanctioned on a monthly basis. The world's changed. And activities has changed. And so as the and we as members or members or among us are members that want to access these issues. But I don't think there's anything that says when you run for the legislature, you get access to your own attorney. The state's going to pay for your attorney. Doesn't say you get to pay for your doctor. You might come down here and have a health problem, but doesn't say while you're here you get medical care. And there are the in so when you get to that issue about what the staff was prepared to do on your behalf, the staff, we're going to find out, but I think you're likely to find that when the legislature hires staff, their LSO staff, that the LSO staff represent all of us. And an individual member will not be able to walk in and ask the staff to issue an opinion that would create a conflict between a single member and the staff. And many times we see folks walk in and said, well, anticipating a problem, I'm going to give you a set of facts, and you tell me whether I'm okay. And then another legislator says, well, yeah, but did he tell you these other relevant facts? And he says, no, if he told me that, my opinion had been differently. And as lawyers, we encounter that all the time. Your clients come in and they said, here's the facts. You go out and investigate them, you say, well, you know, if those had been the only facts, I'd have had one opinion. Learning more facts, I'm going to have to broaden my opinion or narrow it or even change it. But I think everybody is cognizant of this issue, but you're not going to have available to you the right, if you will, to commandeer an attorney and ask him to do something that violates rules of professional conduct. They're not going to do it. They're not charged to do it. And all attorneys have a client. That research has not been completed, and LSO staff is not yet prepared comfortably to tell us it. But I do believe from my own experience and what I just see sort of the body language of those that are researching, which comports to my what's my belief, is that you're likely to find that when this body hires an attorney to represent the body, his client is the attorney general, or excuse me, the legislative body as a whole. You know, when I started out as an AG, we would have administrative hearings in front of the DEQ, and I'd look at the guy next to me and in the same office, and I said, you'd say, well, you want to represent the agency or do you want to represent the staff? So at that time, the agency would be the decision maker. And you say, well, this time I want to prosecute on behalf of the executive officer. And you'd walk into a hearing, and there might be three attorneys that all work together. One represents the board. One would represent the executive officer. And the other one might represent, if there were two agencies, the other one. So three AGs all together that house together representing everyone. Over time, we said, time out. And we created the Office of Administrative Hearings. We did that because we said, this is not right. You can't, the Attorney General can't represent everybody. So we created the Office of Administrative Hearings at great expense to us and the state to have hearing officers who only represent decision makers. Then we divided up boards. Instead of having, you have the Environmental Quality Council being restricted to certain things, we created that council partly in response. So DEQ can prosecute, but they can't be the decision makers at the same time. And this pace that Wyoming has taken is much, much slower than other states. Most of you have probably had some occasion to be encounter federal service where you have the solicitors, so the office of the solicitor that represents agencies. Then there's the office of the attorney general that represents the attorney general, the executive offices. Then even within the Department of Justice, they have different positions to prevent these. And the office of, they have some that are there just to prosecute and go after federal agencies. They're in another agency. So you have three sets of lawyers out there, we're simply not going, I don't think we're going to run out to tomorrow and hire a bunch more lawyers, but at some day you may have to look at the federal model to say, how many attorneys do you need to screw in a light bulb?
Senator Meyer.
Well, we do have a problem with the Attorney General and the tall senator from Natrona County.
Microphone?
It's on.
Are you using the mouse?
We do have a problem with the Attorney General and the tall senator from Natrona County touched on it. And the problem we really have is that the Attorney General does not represent the people of Wyoming. They can't represent the people of Wyoming through their elected representatives because they're restricted. Restricted in the past, restricted even further by this bill. Now, somebody has to represent the people of Wyoming. We're elected to represent the people of Wyoming. And we have a problem with the Attorney General basically being the employee of the governor and the state agencies. And when the state agencies or the governor act contrary to either the law or the Constitution, there's no one to represent the people of Wyoming. We're barred from it because we can't ask the Attorney General opinion because he can't give us one, basically because he's barred from it because of the conflict of interest, because he can only represent the governor and the agencies. We can't represent the people of Wyoming through our elected offices because we don't have an attorney, because our attorneys, they do the good work of this body, and that's their job. The people in Wyoming, the only recourse they have is we can say, we agree with you. Go out and spend $250,000. You might be able to make it to the Supreme Court, and you'll have your day in court. But frankly, Mr. Chairman, there's got to be a better solution to this.
There has to be a better solution to this. Because the Attorney General should be representing the people in Wyoming, not just the governor and the agencies. And that's a frustration that I've had for quite some time, that we have a conflict of interest between basically the largest law firm in the state and the people of the state.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate those comments. You know, we need to pass this bill. Right now there's confusion. There's no way to do anything during the interim. If you look at this bill and read what it says, clearly during a session we can have that Attorney General opinion. We can request that. So what you're saying, I don't agree with it. There's no way for the people to have an opinion. We can do it during the session. And it's in accordance with the rules of the House and the Senate, so we set our own rules. What we also do is we have management council will do it during the interim. Now, if there's a better way to do it, let's bring up a second reading amendment. But if we don't do this, we're back to where we are, which is something that simply is not working. So I would urge the body to vote aye on this. If there's a better way of doing it, let's talk about it. Let's bring a second reading amendment. But if we don't do this, we're back to where we are, which simply doesn't work.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I would observe very briefly, this is all very fine with the legal things, but there's another remedy that we have when it comes to an agency that doesn't follow the law, doesn't do what it's supposed to be, and your opportunity to exercise that remedy will arise next Thursday and Friday, as I understood the schedule.
President Nicholas.
Chairman, that's absolutely correct. Now, if people don't follow the laws, there are remedies in law, the writs of mandamus. They are various extraordinary writs. Certainly, you have to employ your own counsel to do that. That happens. But I would caution everybody to think about what, if you look up the term Attorney General, it's by definition the chief, it's the legal counsel for the chief executive officer. And that's why it's no different than the adjutant general. These are terms of art. And you couldn't, even individually as a legislator, call out the National Guard. And the adjutant general reports to the governor. And these are terms of art. You may be frustrated because you've had access by grace to the governor's attorney that's employed. Now, if you want to create a whole body of enforcement agencies like the federal government, you want to run like the federal government, and you want to pony up that money. But I can tell you that if you've ever worked in the with the office of the solicitor or the office of the attorney general, or if you've gone to the words escape me, but it's the enforcement agency that's there to enforce government agencies, it's an entirely different body. I'll give you the name on second reading.
Is it OMB?
Yeah, it's part of OMB, but it's their attorney branch that you can call and you can make complaints and they'll prosecute. I've had very few clients who found that's very helpful. So, sure, you've had this grace, but attorney generals are what they are. You can't change it. And as my colleague, the majority floor leader, says, this actually does provide a method where we can get opinions outside, and we're sure that they will provide those opinions on a limited basis.
Senator Kinski.
Reminds me when I was at Holy Name Grade School, and we had 35 kids in a class because we didn't have any mandate to have much smaller classes, and Sister Rose Aloysius came in one time. There were two kids causing trouble, and she punished the whole class. She said, it's too bad everybody has to suffer because of a couple bad apples. And we always railed at the injustice of that. When I was mayor in Sheridan, my staff would come to me, and they'd say, we have to pass this ordinance because this developer did X, Y, Z. And I'd say, let's deal with that developer instead of passing an ordinance that punishes the entire development community with onerous requirements. By parallel in this situation,
I would say if there's a couple bad apples, let's come up with a rule that deals with that while preserving the tradition, as the good senator from Lander indicated, of individual legislators to go to the Attorney General for advice. For instance, we might empower the Attorney General to turn down a request because it's trivial, spurious, or just plain stupid, and that legislator would have a remedy of appealing to the Management Council. Then they'd have to make a decision at that point. Or we might, in addition to that, or in lieu of that, we might simply outline what are the circumstances under which a legislator is entitled to seek advice. Is it just general advice or constitutional questions, statutory interpretation? But there certainly has to be a more narrowly tailored solution than this. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
President Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, I know this is a difficult issue for people. We're not going to just skip through it until everybody's answered their questions. But I would take the example that was just described. First of all, you cannot empower somebody with power you don't have. You can't empower. If you don't have the power, you don't have the power. And the issue with respect to the city or town or county is a pretty interesting issue. If you have a county attorney who's elected, who has access to him to write opinions is of limitations. If you have the a city manager, former government, or a mayor, former government, the entity that hires the city attorney, the city attorney has that duty. And not every city council member just gets to walk in and said, give me an opinion on this. Give me an opinion that the city manager or the mayor is a crook, or I don't like him. He would have a conflict. And, in fact, you would have, your budget would run wild if you had to hire enough attorneys to ask everybody. And then if we said to everyone else that now everybody in the public can go to the city attorney and get an opinion if you think that your streets aren't getting shoveled fast enough and you want to see if that's a crime. These issues happen at all levels of government.
Question having been called, all those in favor of Senator Nicholas's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 2, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
The Senate File 2. Division having been called. Division having been called. All those in favor, please rise. All right.
You going to call the numbers, or are you just going to hold
Senate
it?
Senate file. Well, you all those opposed, please rise.
<Come on. laughs>
All right. Senate file.
Are we going to get the vote, or just
yeah, pursuant to the...
What's the vote?
Having failed a standing division, no, we don't want to do that.
What's the vote?
No. All right. The Senate file.
What's the vote?
2 has passed 20-8.
What's the vote?
What's the vote?
20-8.
Okay, 20-8.
20-8.
He didn't want to announce it.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, I move the committee hall rise and report.
After that.
You've heard the motion. The Majority Floor Leader, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The ayes have it.
Bye.
I can make your motion.
If the reading clerk would please read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. President, your Committee of the Whole, having had under considerations bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. Senate Bill 31, do pass. Senate File 45, do pass, amended. Senate File 61, do pass. Senate File 32, do pass, amended. Senate File 46, do pass. Senate File 3, do pass. Senate File 2, do pass. Senator Christensen, Chairman.
Senator Christensen.
Mr. President, I move for the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've all heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The report's been adopted. Do we have any messages? We do have messages. Messages from the House and standing committees? We'll do standing committee amendment, standing committee messages first. Reports.
February 12, 2016, Mr. President, your Committee Number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 68, Budget Short File Measures, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with the recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Burns, Hastert, Perkins, Ross, and Wasserberger, Senator Ross, Chairman. February 12, 2016, Mr. President, your Committee Number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 40, Abandoned Mine Land Funds, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Burns, Hastert, Perkins, and Ross. No, Senator Wasserberger. Senator Ross, Chairman. February 12, 2016, Mr. President, your Committee Number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 71, Local Government Distributions 3, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Burns, Hastert, Perkins, Ross, and Wasserberger. Senator Ross, Chairman. February 12, 2016, Mr. President, your Committee Number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 48, Criminal Justice Reform, respectfully reports same back to the Senate for the recommendation that it return without recommendation. Ayes, Senators Burns, Hastert, Perkins, Ross, and Wasserberger. Senator Ross, Chairman.
Reports or messages from the House.
From the House of Representatives, February 12, 2016, message number 100. Mr. President, the bills listed below passed the House on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. House Bill number 13, Public Records Student Communication. Ayes, 57. Noes, 0. Excused, 3. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. From the House of Representatives, February 12, 2016, message number 101. Mr. President, the bills listed below passed the House on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. House Bill number 55, Nurse Licensure Compact 1, ayes 57, noes 0, excused 3. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. From the House of Representatives, February 12, 2016, message number 102. Mr. President, the bills listed below passed the House on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. House Bill number 56, Advanced Practice Nurse Licensure Compact, ayes 57, noes 0, excused 3. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
That clear the desk? Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. President. And, Mr. President, just for the members of the Senate, I just added it up, and there's over 50 Senate files that we've got to deal with next week, plus a little thing called the budget. That makes 51. So plan on some long days, because we are going to try to get to those Senate files. I don't want to kill a bunch of senators' bill because we don't get to them, so it's going to be a long week. With that, Mr. President, I move that we stand adjourned until 10 a.m. Monday, February the 15th.
Messages. Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 2, Appropriations, will meet Monday morning in the Jonah Room L55, which is the JAC meeting room to consider the following bills. Senate File 41, State-Funded Capital Construction. Senate File 83, School Facilities Appropriations. Senate File 102, Federal Funds Distribution. And Senate File 103, At-Will Employment Contracts.
I apologize. I should have said announcements. Senator Coe.
Mr. President, your Committee Number 4, Education, will meet Monday morning at 8 o'clock in Jonah Room S-19 to take up Senate File 85, Medical Education, Senate File 97, Student and School Safety Call Center, and Senate File 94, Payment for Educational Services.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, your Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will get the long week off to an early start. We will meet at 7:30 a.m. Committee members note the time, 7:30 a.m., Jonah Room, S-27, Senate File 60, Public Health Nursing, Senate File 58, Involuntary Hospitalization and Treatment, continuing from what we were working on this morning, Senate File 55, Licensure Board Powers, Senate File 86, Medical Assistance Program Design, and, if time should permit, Senate File 82, Palliative Care.
Senator Von Flatern.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your Committee Number 9, Minerals and Economic Development, will meet this Monday, shortly after noon recess, to consider Senate File 39, Cease and Transfer Priority List, Senate File 64, Industrial Siting Permit Amendments, Senate File 65, Patent Trolling, and if time permits, and we hope so, Senate File 74, State Miners Hospital Board Employees.
Senator Christensen.
Mr. President, your Judiciary Committee Number 1 will meet Monday, February 15th, 8 a.m. at the Jonah Room, S-18, to consider the following bills. Senate File 75, Criminal Trespass to Collect Data Amendments. Senate File 76, Criminal Trespass to Collect Data Amendments. Senate File 96, Marijuana Edibles.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, your Committee Number 8, Transportation, will meet upon adjournment on Monday the 15th in Jonah Room S-27 to consider the following bills. Senate File 4, Military Service Member Protections. Senate File 12, Vietnam War Commemoration. Senate File 70, Off-Road Recreational Vehicles.
Any further announcements? You heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion has been adopted. The Senate shall stand adjourned until 10 a.m. Monday, February 15th.